now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you to another broadcast, our 4,986th broadcast.
Isn't it or something. 4 millionth?
Yeah. Well, no, but hey, you sound like it's like too many. It's not enough.
Well, you know, I was out in Clarkston for the Taste of Clarkston today doing a live broadcast, and it was a little cold and a little rainy. My voice is even lower than it normally is, but I want to shout out to Chef Scott at Clarkston Union.
Oh, Chef Scott, thank you for that mac and cheese, lobster mac and cheese.
Yeah, he hooked us up real well.
And a great dessert.
Yeah, he does a great job up there at that restaurant. And, and that they have the woodshed down the street, the other restaurant. That's where the dessert came from, which was the butterscotch pudding with smoked sea salt. Did you catch the smokiness?
I did.
So anyway,
thank you,
great
Chef
job
Scott.
Up there. Everyone go up to Clarkston Union and
you might run into
eat.
Kid Rock.
You might.
You might run into Ann Carlini.
He said that a lot of people ask him, where's Kid Rock? Where's Kid Rock? Ever since it was on the Food Network, that's all it's about.
Yeah. Well, hey, this is not a foodie show, although we could do one of these days. Actually, tonight at 1 a.m. or 1:30, depending on which I choose, there'll be a recorded interview with an author talking about our food.
Yes.
And so she probably wouldn't think too highly of lobster mac and cheese because it is so high in fat.
But it's so worth it.
Yeah. You know, the big tasters, in fact, I opened the interview with this, the big tasters for us is salt, sugar, and fat.
Well, but of course.
Well, you say that usually think about, like evolution. Wouldn't you think evolution would kind of channel us towards broccoli and whole wheat?
Well, that's you. You would think that.
No. Seriously, because it's, you know, what's adaptive within the process of evolving? And if we didn't have people telling us, hey, if you just eat a lot of salt and fat and sugar, you're not going to do very well. That's all we'd eat.
Right? I don't know. Nothing's going to stop me.
The reason, by the way,
I sit over here and eat sugar every single show.
Yes, you do.
I have a small candy store here.
The reason, and I don't know how you do it, I always get stuck in my teeth. Anyway, that's a little too much information, I guess. Anyway, the reason we're talking about such frivolous subjects, there's nothing really very important happening in the.
Are a few. Nothing at all.
Well, let's set the context a little broader here because this is a phone-in talk show. This 24/7, except for right now. This is a major rock and roll station, not only in Detroit, but in the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they turn the airwaves over to not only us, but you as well, the listener. Well, I guess like Chuck and Dave the Freak in the morning, they have...
Wait, Dave and Chuck the Freak?
What did I say?
Chuck and Dave the Freak. I think Dave would probably think that's kind of fun once in a while.
All right.
Hey, George Romney, Mitt Romney, who cares?
Yeah. All right.
They know who we mean.
So this is Pete Angeline the Freak.
Well, that one worked.
Yeah, Dave and Chuck the Freak. They take calls as well. Anyway, the number that you call into for both shows is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And the great issues of the day can be discussed, although we would, uncharacteristically, we would ask you to wait because Jefferson, our phone screener, is out doing important biz for the station in the promotions
department.
He'll
be right back.
So he will be there, and when he comes in, Jefferson, and he is so diligent that I just feel like he's probably listening as he's driving and going, oh, no.
I told him not to stress.
Don't stress. You know, because if the phones blew out, Jolene and I could yak it up for the next 5 hours.
We have been known to do that.
Yeah, but we really do want your participation. In the meantime, if you want to email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll get some emails from you, maybe comment on those. My personal website is Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And we also have a great Facebook page that Jolene and Debbie put together. Debbie, who lives in Western Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but so hi, Debbie.
We have help all over the place.
And
she really helps me.
And we have listeners and callers all around the world.
We do.
Always, you know, I think this is a good show. Well, wait a minute. We had a meeting about this. This is not a good show. This is a great show.
Thank you, Peter.
Right. Okay. But I'm always curious of why people are listening in Finland and Mexico and Shanghai and Seoul and Tasmania.
I think oftentimes it's people who formerly lived in the United States.
Sometimes.
Progressive.
Detroit.
Who found us, and oftentimes, lately, ever since we became not syndicated nationally anymore, they hear about us through other progressives who listen to Mike Malloy and different progressive hosts around the country.
Right. So, hold on a bit. What we do is terrible. We have the phones on hold, so you'll just get a busy tone. I will let you know. Maybe Jefferson will just slip in and take the phones off hold, and then we'll know, whoa, we're ready.
Yeah.
Ready to
we
do it.
We could take cold calls.
Yeah, we could. Do you know what that means, folks?
Oh, cold calls, just that you don't know who it is or what they want to talk about.
I've done that.
Yeah.
Because we're on, what, like, we used to be on a 7-second delay. Now we're on, like, what, like a 35-second delay?
I think it's, it's around there.
Really? I mean, a long delay.
I think it's like 30 seconds or, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. No
you
matter.
Change it.
But here are words that you probably have never heard escape my lips. I love this because Jeline's going, what in the hell is he going to say? Thank you, Republicans.
Really?
And you're going, all right, he's going to bash Republicans.
He's got something up his sleeve.
I am going to bash Republicans, but I'll try just to thank you for being part of the anti-war movement.
Yeah, it's amazing, huh?
Yeah, we went to this demonstration in Royal Oak. This was part of, international protest last Monday against the Obama plan to bomb Syria because of their use of their alleged...
Because of someone's use of chemical weapons.
It sounds like tomorrow, Monday, that the United Nations is going to issue a report which will say definitively that it did come from the Syrian military, that they were launched by missiles.
But it wasn't at someone's directive.
No,
wasn't
no,
this
no.
kind of the rogue?
Well, wait. I mean, Assad is, the leftovers are the worst of the worst.
So, sure.
And for once, he's not a U.S. ally. Usually the worst of the worst over the last 100 years or so have been our allies, and still some of them are.
Shamefully.
Like Saudi Arabia, for instance.
They certainly are.
Yeah.
Who
have they whipped for adultery this week? But in any event, the Republicans are among the political population that are the most opposed to a strike against Syria. And then in second place are people that call themselves independents, which I'm never really quite sure who that is. Does that mean that sometimes the people vote for Democrats and sometimes they vote for Republicans?
Well, we kind of consider ourselves,
but the different kind of
independent.
I mean, we're independent of both political
yes.
parties. Well, I guess that's what independents mean.
Yeah.
And
but we
then,
don't go back and forth.
No.
We don't go over to the Republican
side.
Ever.
Yeah, exactly. And the people who most supported a strike against Syria were the Democrats. And I think a lot of it came down to, when you hear their statements, they did not want to humiliate the president by not letting him get congressional approval, whereas the Republicans were all about humiliating him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, too bad one way or the other, if he got humiliated or not, that a strike against Syria would do no good for anyone.
Yeah, I noticed your no war signs back in your yard.
Yeah, I did. I took that out. I remember that's probably 10 years old from the last, at least this one might have a modicum of truth.
Yeah.
The Bush War just wound up with thousands and thousands and thousands of people dead, and it's getting worse and worse in Iraq now, of course.
It's terrible.
4,000 people have been killed by bombs in Iraq since, May or something like that.
I had this friend of a conversation with my friend who's grew up outside of Baghdad in a village. Talked to him tonight about it, and we were talking about that whole thing. But my no war sign deteriorated into nothing. I do not have one anymore.
Well, what you may probably everyone knows by now is that that the Russians. This is so bizarre. The Russians
are the peacemakers.
They have made a deal with the U.S. I guess this is still the world of superpowers. And interestingly, the Syrian government has hailed this as a victory. Then now the Republicans are saying, the United States has been weakened and all of that. And I said last week, if this would have been President Romney, the Republicans would have been all about this war. I mean, they would have been frothing at the mouth because they love militarism and
they like supporting their buddies, the big business.
In the meantime, that the President Bashar al-Assad's jets and military have hit rebel suburbs of the capital. I mean, around the capital, Damascus, there's actually these rebel-held areas, and they had begun this offensive last week. But none of this makes a bit of sense. There's nothing from a little strike. And remember, at one point, I think Secretary of State Kerry said, if you make a pinprick attack, and I'm thinking, so what will that do?
That doesn't exist.
Yeah, but if it did, what would it do?
Yeah.
Like nothing.
Like kill no one?
And if there was like a really big one, who would that wind up hurting?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the military has dispersed all of its weapons and its, you know, its airplanes and everything like that. President Obama dismissed critics of his quick changing tactics on Syria. Nothing wrong with quickly changing them. If you don't like people changing them, you call them flip-floppers, right?
Yeah.
If you do like it changed, we're glad that he decided not to attack Syria, and the vast majority of American people are. But he says that the critics are focusing on, quote, style rather than policy. And let's see.
What does he mean by that, style?
Well, they just say he appears weak
and
indecisive and what have you. And that's a whole bigger deal. The fact that there's still this posturing on the world stage that there's a necessity for the United States to be involved all across the world in everything that's going on. And do people really think that that is something that benefits our country? Certainly not the trillions that are wasted on militarism.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
If one thinks that, they really haven't looked into what people around the world, how they view us because of that.
Yeah, not well.
And it's not well at all.
By the way, just parenthetically, I meant to say there was a demonstration last Monday, 7 o'clock, at the Shrine of the Little Flower, in front of it, not involved with it, on Woodward and 12 Mile Road in Royal Oak, and there were a number of listeners that came out, including someone, and if I had a memory of, other than for historic events, I would remember the person that came all the way from Ann Arbor because he heard us talking about
it. Well, I apologize for not being there everywhere. I mean,
I wasn't going to out you.
Full disclosure. Well, here's the thing. I was on the air until 1 o'clock in the morning here.
Yeah.
Went to bed, got on the air at 9 o'clock in the morning at our sister station, worked all day, and I went home and took a nap, and that nap...
That was it.
That was it. So
yeah.
I apologize.
I told
people. I was working too hard.
Yeah. And, someone came from Ann Arbor, and what was there? And someone, and this, for some reason, really heartened me, is that someone said, this is the first political demonstration I've ever been at.
Oh, that's so great. I wish I would have been there. Oh.
And it was, and everyone said, where's Jalene?
Oh, I feel so bad.
They did, really.
I was so, I was pooped. I was done.
And I
start working on Sundays. Full disclosure, at noon. I work basically all day and take a little break and come back. So it's a rough start of the week for me usually. And they do all these demonstrations on Monday when I'm ready to
Well, there's another one. Let's see.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow. The usual one at the corner of 9 Mile Road and Woodward.
That's been going on since the Iraq War.
Yeah, 445, I think.
445. Yeah. These people are amazing. They never stop going. It's beautiful.
There's one guy who was clean shaven, short hair, and when this war of Bush's on Iraq, based on all these lies, no weapons of mass destruction or anything like that, destroyed the country, and everything he did has just caused nothing but horrendous death and a waste of billions and into the trillions for us, which is nothing compared to the loss of life.
Now he grew his hair?
So he grew his hair. He said he wasn't going to shave
or
get
his hair
cut until Bush got out of office.
Oh.
And he thought he would get out in 2004.
So he got pretty hairy. Oh, I think I remember seeing him.
And I just saw him at this, and I said, hey, man, what's the deal? He said, they're all the same. I'm just, and by the way.
Did he cut it off?
No.
No, it's still.
Yeah. By the way, this idea that both parties are the same, there are similarities, particularly in how they relate to Wall Street and imperial presidents. The projection of military power across the world is very similar, to be sure. But there, it would have been horrendous for, let me see, what was the guy's name? Mitt Romney, right. For Mitt Romney.
Tough for you.
Yeah, remember him? how fortunate we are to soon we forget. But anyway, not to have had the policies of Mitt Romney taking precedent. And again, it's not that Barack Obama fulfills all of our dreams.
Our progressive wishes.
Our progressive wishes and all that. But if you think it's bad now, you can only imagine how it would have been if Mitt Romney would have been in there. Can you imagine Meatloaf singing rather than Beyonce? I know probably some of you, you know, rockers and hate R&B probably think, well, that'd be good.
Yeah, but you know, when these
Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Yeah, these, I mean, hey, good song.
Two out of three?
Two out of three ain't bad.
Bad, yeah.
Too bad. It's always a disappointment when we find out some of our favorite rockers, support people like Mitt Romney.
Yeah. Let's see, what else is in this article? So there now, for the time being, there is not going to be a strike against Syria. Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan and the chair of the Armed Forces Committee of the Senate, says that we keep this force as a potential, though, and that apparently that the Assad regime has 1 week to provide an inventory of all the chemical weapons. And then, I guess, to the middle of 2014, to turn them over to the United Nations.
So they'll still be hanging on to them for a while.
Huh? Well, I don't think they'll use them again, but in here, one of the rebels said, let's see.
The thing is maybe sometimes it's not even about them using it, you know? It's about the wrong people getting a hold of it, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's
get it out of there.
So the rebels calling the international focus on poison gas a sideshow. These are the people who it was used against, at least their area. Have dismissed talk that the arms pact might herald peace talks, which they don't want. They don't want peace talks, the rebels. They said Assad has stepped up an offensive with ordinary weaponry now that the threat of U.S. airstrikes has receded. A spokesman for the opposition Syrian National Coalition repeated that it wanted world powers to prevent Assad from using his air force, tanks, and military on civilian areas. Shadi Hamid of the Brookings Doha Center wrote in the Atlantic magazine, Assad is effectively being rewarded for the use of chemical weapons. Now he can get away with nearly anything as long as he sticks to using good old conventional weapons. 100,000 people have died. And I don't know what you do. I mean, is the United States under, popular opinion opposes the United States suddenly, what a popular opinion does, being the policeman of the world. But what's the responsibility of other countries? You know, there was a civil war in which 400,000 people died. Let me see. What country was that in?
Maybe right here.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The United States. And there was great consternation that that either Britain, particularly Britain, would come in on the side of the South that for a lot of economic reasons having to do with cotton and all of that. But the idea that there would have been a country that intervened in the United States Civil War, even though there was a slaughter of untold proportion, nothing like the American Civil War had ever occurred before. I mean, it presaged what happened with all the modern wars, you know, World War I and II and what have you. But I don't know how we do this, because the United States rarely enters these conflicts with clean hands. And sometimes makes things worse. There are some successes, but those...
Iraq. Worse.
Yeah, worse. Sorry. Yeah. No one moved around Rwanda, and about 150,000 people were killed. On the other hand, the United States and other powers intervene in Kosovo, and...
Think about these refugee crises.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how. I mean, if you're not going to have United Nations agreement that, the Security Council, that you could say, well, no internal conflict is allowable.
Solved externally.
They would say if they were to make the proposition that no internal conflict that took large amounts of lives would be allowed, and then a United Nations force would intervene. Well, sometimes the people, the rebels are good. Sometimes the rebels are bad. You know, how do you?
Who
I don't
are
know
you
what
dealing
you do.
With? It depends on who you're dealing with. Yes.
And now, like Assad, pretty bad, and a lot of these rebels are pretty bad. There's a whole secular group of them, but there's also all these jihadists and Islamic extremists that have been called upon to stream into Syria's next battle. against, well, partly against the West, because they dream of capturing a state. And as you, Jalene, as you said earlier, if they capture a state with chemical weapons, or if they capture a state with nuclear weapons, like Pakistan, it's not going to be pretty.
No.
Yeah. All right, so I was thanking the Republicans for getting on board with the anti-war movement. Hey, guys, welcome on.
Way to do everything for the wrong reason.
Yeah, right,
But it's so right. No
pun. Let's see. Jerry writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The reason we're not taking phone calls right now is that our phone screener isn't here, that he also, Jefferson also does a lot of work with our promotions department.
Yeah, he's on his way. He's out of the gig.
Yeah. And Jerry writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Did I misunderstand you? You said that the UN is going to confirm who used chemical weapons. You are mistaken. Their mission was to confirm only their use, not who used them. Well, we'll see. I think that is why there is still such a bent to attack, because if Syria turns all their stuff in and it does not match up with what was found to be used, someone would be rather embarrassed. Well, yeah. I'm sorry. That's what I was reading today, that they're actually going to give
full disclosure.
Full disclosure. They're going to give agency.
Of what they think they know, right?
who did it? Yeah. So what is going to happen now then, and apparently this is the plan, that Israel will be the only country in the Middle East with weapons of mass destruction. Now, is this the only way to go about it? I mean, now, countries, Syria, Iran, freelancers like Al-Qaeda and all that think that the United States and the West in general are the great devils. And the United States and Britain, Western powers, think people like Assad and Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and all that are these awful, crazy Islamic extremists. Mm-hmm. And so it depends on when you're, where you're sitting.
It's a matter of perspective.
Yeah, yeah. We're here. We think that they're pretty bad. They're over there in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and they're great heroes, for instance.
Yeah.
Same thing.
For the people, because, you know, a lot of these groups, some of these groups are, their interest is in that of the civilians, civilians who have been killed by the West.
Yeah. So you have a situation where it's what would you say, unmitigated antagonism. And how could you possibly how could you possibly ever resolve this? And some people say, you know, people in the East often say there's been a 1,000-year war of the West against Islam. I mean, they've done, I think I mentioned this the other week, I mean, after the Crusades, where the United States, they weren't around, where the West sacked Constantinople, which is Istanbul today, where they captured Jerusalem, killed 30,000 people, the Crusaders killed 30,000 people by hand.
God.
Yeah, they were some mean MFs.
Ooh, I guess
But they were doing it for the Lord.
You know,
they had the best of intentions.
Always in the name of
some god or other.
Some lord of some sort.
And then, but Islam made it at different times back pretty deep into the West. Controlled Spain at one time, made it into Serbia, didn't they? Where there was a big battle there. Again, I don't have all this in front of me. But anyway, so how do you?
I think you're doing pretty well, though.
Yeah, okay. How do you end this antagonism? Well, one of the things that you do. I mean, remember, I've always I've told this story lots of times. I was at dinner over on the southwest side, and this with this couple we know, and my wife and I, and this guy comes in, friend of ours, bursts through the door, shirt's ripped, face bloody, and he says, "What happened?" He said, "I was over at a bar, you know, and I got in this big fight." And we said, "Wow." He said, "It happens every time I go in there."
So why do you keep going back?
What's the lesson here? Yeah, unless you want to fight.
I think he wanted to fight.
Yeah, he did. But the point being, some disengagement would be in order to get out of their faith. That's interesting.
Whoa.
That's an interesting slip of the tongue.
That was a trip.
I lift.
Yeah, but it worked.
Yes.
Yes, it worked.
Yes, it did. Get out of their face and get out of their faith.
Yeah.
Now, George Bush's stupid remark, although that's sort of almost an oxymoron.
Yes, it is.
How do you know he's making a stupid remark?
His mouth is open.
That's right. And he said that they hate us because of our freedoms. They don't hate us because of their freedom.
I mean, that, you know, he tainted people's brains with that. Yeah. God, that makes me mad.
They hated us because of our constant meddling in the affairs of the Middle East and Asia and what have you. I mean, they might hate
and
us anyway.
And other places.
They might hate us anyway, but there'd be less friction if we weren't in their face and in their faith.
Yeah.
And so how could we end this? I mean, this sounds almost stupid because it sounds so improbable. But how about a real big peace treaty with the belligerents? How about a non-aggression pact with within the Middle East, make the Middle East a weapons of mass destruction free zone,
yeah.
Which means Israel would have to admit that it has nuclear weapons, which it does, and the United States.
Helen
Thomas.
You're dreaming big.
Yeah, I am. Helen Thomas, the news reporter that just died.
Yes.
And she, the first question she asked President Obama in 2009 was, does Israel have nuclear weapons? And he wouldn't say yes. Everyone in the world knows that Israel has nuclear weapons. So everybody would have to disarm, that Iran couldn't have them, Israel couldn't have them, no chemical weapons, begin to take back all those billions and billions of dollars of weapons that we've sold to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And figure, why does any of them need it?
But to be against each other, yeah. You know, that's...
Well, let me review. I don't think that there, other than Israel, I don't think there is any country that has plans for territorial aggrandizement. Iran does not want to conquer Jordan, and Syria does not want to conquer, the Gulf Emirates or anything like that. So in a lot of ways, nobody needs any weapons. So you say, well, yeah, you can't trust them. Well, stuff is verifiable, to be sure. You'd have to find out verifiable ways. And one of the things, the United States is so powerful, so immensely powerful, it's not like we would set ourselves back any if we took a chance, because there's no chance what's going on here. Something's going to explode. If it's not in the next 10 days, it'll be in the next 10 months or the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. But situations like this are like exactly what preceded World War I. With all these small
That's
little
scary,
states, all these antagonisms, this sort of just irresistible drive towards war, everybody armed to the teeth, great connections. Because, you know, during World War I, all these emperors and kings and czars, they were all literally family. They were all related. And none of them wanted the war, and it all occurred. So that would be the first thing, a Middle East weapons of mass destruction free zone. Did you point?
No.
You just pushed up your sleeve.
Yeah.
All right.
Don't mind me over here.
Okay. I was looking at some emails that are coming in.
Big giant peace treaty.
Big giant peace treaty. And we could do that with China. I mean, China does not want to go to war. China does not want to conquer the United States. United States does not want to conquer China. Japan wanted this control, literally, to make all of Southeast Asia, what was it, co-prosperity, something or other, zone. And they wanted to virtually enslave all these populations. China doesn't want to do that. They're going to rule the world just financially.
Yeah, they're already kind of there.
And one of the things, so real quickly here, let's see, where did that go to? It was, the archenemy of the United States, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, called on Muslims to carry out, quote, a few scattered attacks on American soil to bleed America economically, according to a recent translation. Mr. Zawahiri.
I can never keep track of who's in charge.
He's in charge now.
Okay.
Laid out a strategy involving economic pressures and terrorist attacks to wage, quote, war on its own land against the United States and to force Washington to maintain high levels of military spending to weaken its economy. He said, we should bleed America economically by provoking it to continue in its massive expenditure on its security, for the weak point is its economy, which has already begun to stagger due to the military and security expenditure. This is truly frightening, folks.
They actually get what's going on, as they are.
I'm beginning to forget more than I know. Well, there's a book by a historian named Kennedy, maybe. It's called the Rise and Fall of the Great Empires, the Great Nations. And every one of them, you know, Rome to Britain, what have you, it was military overextension. That it was trying to control too much beyond its own geography.
Wow, that sounds really familiar.
Yeah. Hello. Yeah. And do you know what it cost? In fact, I don't. So maybe someone could, you can't call yet, but you could email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and tell us what it cost to keep the 7th Fleet per day in the Eastern Mediterranean. I mean, it's like tens of millions of dollars a day just to have all our ships over there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, don't bail out Detroit.
Yeah.
Where are you going?
Let's not do that. I'm just seeing if I got a text from our producer.
Did you?
I'm looking.
Okay. How about in the meantime? And we'll continue to talk about this. And also what Obama says about Iran.
I did. Ah, yeah. He said, thanks for the mention.
I'll be there in 2 hours. All right. Send us some emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll get your calls as soon as Jefferson gets here.
Actually, you know,
you're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
My mum always says, hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice, as usual. So we worked very hard to make GEICO.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at GEICO.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit GEICO.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash beyond my ears this morning.
It's football season at Buffalo Wild Wings, and there's no other place that packs in the action like we do. When there's a timeout during a game, you're watching another game. And when you're not watching that game, you're watching another game. With over 50 big screens, your eyes won't miss any of the action, and neither will your taste buds. You'll enjoy hand-spun wings and 16 signature sauces and 5 seasonings, ultimate nachos, burgers, and over 20 beers on draft. Maybe action-packed is a bit of an understatement.
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Fun fact of the day. Esurance was built to save you money on car insurance, which is great if you happen to be saving money for a rainy day or a sunny day. Holidays, birthdays, Mondays, Tuesdays, bad days, Wednesdays, good days, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, lazy days, and Sundays. Any days, really. Esurance saves you money on all of them, so have a great day. Esurance. Insurance for the modern world. Now backed by Allstate.
Visit Esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in Allstate. Savings may vary. Allstate products are not available through Esurance.
Attention business owners, this is Tony Robbins. I've spent the last 3 decades helping companies create serious business breakthroughs, and I want to help you like never before.
And this is Chet Holmes, author of the #1 business book, The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you've heard my radio spots before, maybe you don't know that about 2,000 action-oriented business owners call us every week to get our free reports. But it was Tony Robbins that challenged me to go even further for you.
Chet and I have built a serious training program called 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
And here's what Tony convinced me to do.
We're going to give this to any business owner who calls us at 800-936-0222. Just call with your email address, and we'll email you this phenomenal audio training program at our expense, not yours.
It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months.
Call and leave us a voicemail with your email, and we'll give you a program that others have paid dearly to receive. Call right now. That's 1-800-936-0222.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
Opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. This is our second segment. We're not taking any phone calls right now because our phone screener is on his way.
You're lying. We took a phone call.
Oh, no, we did. We did during the break. We can do it. That's the only time we can do it. So you can try calling in. What I was saying was that, first off, I said, thank you, Republicans, for joining the anti-war movement and really making up the majority of people, probably, who oppose President Obama's threat against Syria. Now Russia and the United States have come to an agreement that Syrian chemical weapons first will be accounted for by next Friday and then confiscated under the control of the United Nations by mid-2014. Will this do anything to change the equation in Syria? No. I mean, it's not even clear what's going on. A number of players there, particularly Israel, would just assume the whole thing kept going. Because if it kills a lot of Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, people in Hezbollah from Lebanon is directed northward, that's fine with them. And if Assad just keeps getting pounded, yeah. They're happy.
All right.
They're happy.
Yeah, I'm convinced the Republicans at this point that they really will not go along with anything.
Yeah,
I mean,
this,
I was convinced of that before. And I think Obama could say, President Obama could say, hey, I am going to loosen up all gun regulations and you know, so
stop
anyone,
abortion.
I'm going to be anti-abortion, Roe v. Wade out the window. They would probably argue with that.
Well, that's a good, maybe that's a strategy.
I know. Yeah. I'm full of them.
So I was talking earlier, how do we ever come to a resolution of this and always have it being done on a military basis? And this is a warfare state we live in, and we've assisted any number, in fact, great numbers of other countries around the world to have a similar posture. But no other country in the world is foolish enough to expend that much on armaments to the point where it actually distorts the economy. And the head of Al-Qaeda now, Ayman al-Zawahiri, he says, well, that's great because that they plan to bleed America dry.
That's been their plan all along.
Yeah. That
and look at our economy.
Military overextension will just keep the United States economy from ever recovering. He says keeping America in tension and anticipation of terrorist attacks only costs a few scattered attacks here and there, meaning as we defeated it in the gang warfare in Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, and Afghanistan, so should we follow it with that war on its own land. So here, because of the United States interference in the Middle East and other Asian countries, Afghanistan and what have you, this is why we are under attack. So I said, how do we resolve all this? How about, to begin with, a peace conference that guarantees the security of every state? I mean, the United States is powerful enough that it could do that. I mean, Iran, no matter what armaments it has, is never going to attack Israel, that it would be wiped out in like half a second. So it's not going to do anything like that. Could everything be resolved? Maybe not internally, but of different countries. United States make a permanent peace treaty and non-aggression treaty with China. I mean, why do we have weaponry that considers China as a potential enemy? Why do we and Russia have atomic weapons targeting each other's cities, including Detroit, on hair trigger alert now? Now, I'm not talking about the 1950s. I'm talking about right now when there's really no possibility of war except by an escalation that comes out of insane incidents like this. I don't know how many of you remember your history of World War One, but it came about because there was a archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo. And so how could then wind up 30 million people die?
Oh, my God.
That's insane.
It is.
So what do you think? All right. Let's. We do have one caller that we're able to sneak in. And who's it, Jillian? Who's it?
This is Truk.
Truk.
Is alleged name. And he was first allegedly from Austria. Now he's somewhere in Canada.
All right,
this
Truk.
Ought to be good.
Truk, go ahead. You're on the air.
You got to hit the button there, Pete.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Truk. Yeah. Hey, Truk, you're on the air.
Oh, we weren't on the air all before?
What do you mean? We were? Yeah.
We were on the air the whole time.
this is already going well. I can tell.
Yeah, yeah. You're on strike two. Let's go ahead. What's up?
Okay, well, hey, shut the radio off, Jane. I'm on the radio.
Not for long.
2.5.
Well, so anyways, Syria, right?
What's that?
You want to talk about that? Is that what we want to talk
about?
Yeah,
go ahead, but do it.
Okay. Well, basically what happens is with them is that Syria and Iran have this this pact. And basically what they're doing is that they every time anybody strikes Syria, Iran has to go in and do it. Now, Iran is the only country aside from Cuba that has the not a Rothschild centralized banking system. And so basically what's going to happen there is that they're going to go and they're going to, that's the reason why that they're trying to take it over.
Well, okay, let me say thank you for that. As soon as one here, now most people don't understand this, but there were, and I wouldn't expect that you
would. What was the trigger?
What was the key word? What was the key word?
I was not actually listening to, I'm sorry, I was over here doing something else.
Key word there was
bad.
Rothschild.
Oh, okay.
That's the Jews are behind it. When he said
what he's saying.
Yeah, he's saying Rothschild centered.
I knew that because we've heard this before.
And this is so insane, I don't even want to deal with it. I mean, if you start with that crap, you can't even think straight about it. Iran and Syria do not have a pact at all. But there was something here where Iran said if the United States attacked Syria, that it would launch some attack in response without specifying exactly where or what the nature of it would be. And again, you have to think about it. Wait a minute. There was, where was that piece? Because there was, I know where it was, because I wanted to, remember earlier I was thanking the Republicans for joining the anti-war movement, but you know, the putting forth of the imperative word now with an exclamation point goes back to the militants of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And because everyone else would say, we have to negotiate all this and we have to sit down, and they would say, you know, we want our rights now. Or people would say, get out of Vietnam now.
Yeah.
And when, you know, no negotiations, nothing. Out. In fact, one of the big slogans was two words, out now.
Right.
Okay. So when you hear, get out of Afghanistan now, what
commie?
Who do
you think of?
Yeah, you know, what commie said this?
I would think it was you or me.
Yeah, all right. It was Nolan Finley, one of the most horrible men in Detroit, who is on the wrong side of every question.
He writes for the Detroit News.
Yeah, he's the editorial director, who is so awful on everything. And he has this long column where he essentially says, he doesn't essentially say, he says, get out of Afghanistan now. It's the lead
editorial.
So now
all the Republicans are going into this anti-war thing?
Yeah, yeah.
They're Nazi. I mean, I'm glad.
They're Nazis?
They're Nazi.
Oh, Nazi.
Nuts. Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, I thought you said they were Nazis.
Well,
don't go there. But here, actually, there's some, he can't totally help himself. You almost could just say this came from anybody on the left.
By the way, I just hung up on someone. I didn't mean to. Call back. Okay.
Okay. I did you? Okay.
I did.
President Barack Obama, this is Nolan Finley in the Detroit News, reminded Americans in his speech on Syria, on the Syria crisis, that he was elected to end wars, not start them. Afghanistan, he says, should be a good place to apply his war-ending prowess. This is the war that candidate Obama called the right war and assured us that he knew how to win it. Well, both were wrong. And if anybody wants to challenge me on that, that was not, the going into Afghanistan was a horrible mistake. It has destroyed that country. The losses are a couple of thousand on the American side and thousands of Afghan. It's now his war. He's been president for 5 of the 8 years America has been fighting and dying. Now, here, in that miserable pile of rocks.
When did he come to this conclusion? Clearly,
I don't know.
Because he's never been like this.
Oh, here is, Finley. Here's the exact figure that Nolan Finley relates. Of the 2,144 Americans who have died in Afghanistan, 73% have been killed on Obama's watch. Well, that's what he was left with. I don't know. I mean, he could have immediately, and many of us called for that. As soon as he came into office,
pulled
them all right out.
Right.
Yeah. The war has been drifting along towards the end of 2014 withdrawal date that Obama set with no strategy for and no hope of winning. In the meantime, the president claims to have set Afghanistan aside, rarely talking about the conflict that is still claiming American lives. Let's see. Syria exposed that Al-Qaeda isn't nearly defeated, and the Taliban, the real troublemakers in Afghanistan, aren't either. Now, the real troublemaker in Afghanistan and in Iraq is the United States. You guys that may have been over there. You were sent over there and probably fought with the best of intention. If you weren't pissing on people, dead corpses, and, you know, running through villages killing women and children.
That was pretty awful.
Well, yeah, there was some bad stuff. But there was also, you see units trying to create something good over there, which there's no reason that we should be. Those guys should have been in Detroit and St. Louis.
And women.
And women, yeah. Let's see. This summer, Obama engaged in a nasty exchange with the Afghan president. And afterward, the president floated the zero option, getting out of Afghanistan entirely and at a faster pace, leaving no peacekeeping force, just as he did in Iraq. This means Afghanistan will likely follow the Iraqi path of receding into chaos, I agree, and civil war. So Nolan Findlay, now an anti-war Republican.
What is going on
here? If that's the case, he asks, why stay another day? In February, 34,000 of the 63,000 U.S. troops are scheduled to pull out, making it unlikely any additional significant progress will be made in stabilizing Afghanistan. Militants in Afghanistan are crafting plans for what they expect will be a civil war once the U.S. leaves. And here, Nolan Findlay ends, I'm editing this as I go along. We must admit the truth. When we come home at the end of next year, Afghanistan will return to the same internal feuding and killing that has marked its history, and we will have accomplished nothing. Well, it's marked its history because of continued, Russian colonialism. British colonialism, Russian domination, United States
invasion.
Everyone's
been after them. I mean, for how long, Peter?
Yeah. The president claims to be a war ender, says Nolan Findlay. We should end this one now. Where were you 10 years ago, Nolan?
Yeah. Now, listen, you always write him when he writes something you don't like.
Yeah, I forgot to write Nolan. Welcome to the anti-war movie.
But you
movie.
Could throw in, where were you 10 years ago? You don't have to be completely nice.
All right, we're just going to put some people on hold and I guess take them cold, huh?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a...
Line one, Peter.
Yeah, but let me see. Here, this is the one I was missing. Iran plots revenge, according to the U.S., if the United States strikes Syria. All right, we'll try this. I don't know how it's going to work. Let's see. Hi, you are on the air. Who's this and where are you calling from?
This is Truk Frook, and I'm calling from Austria.
That's the same guy.
You're out of here, dude. You can only call once, and you gave your crazy little opinion.
Yeah. This is why we have phone screeners.
Yeah, this is why. there's a couple of other things in here. This is Howard Friel, who is this man? He wrote a piece called The Threat to Attack Syria is Still Illegal. He says, unless President Obama would like to risk seeing Syria at some point in the future renounce its signature on the Chemical Weapons Convention that it signing, which it has recently pledged to sign, rather, under the threat of attack by the United States, the United States should rescind its threat of force. This is because Article 52 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, coercion of a state by threat or use of force, stipulates a treaty is void of its conclusion has it been procured by the threat or use of force in violation of the principles of international law embodied in the Charter of the United Nations. So the very fact that Syria is engaging into this agreement under threat of force really means it's null and void.
That is so scary.
Yeah. And Howard Friel.
I mean, is it just continued posturing? Are they even going to do this?
Who's they?
Syria.
Well, I mean, they don't want to be bombed. There's no extent of bombing that could alter the nature of the civil war there. And in fact, probably what would happen is that if the advantage went tipped more towards the rebels, there'd probably just be more killings.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And meanwhile, people are just, you see images of Damascus, and people are just wandering through town shopping and buying their food and going to the market. And I can't imagine one of the oldest markets they showed in Damascus, and it was just full of people.
No.
And I thought, how do these people go out of their houses every day? That they're just so immune to it.
One of the things that the United States is currently doing, and by sending in the 7th Fleet into the Eastern Mediterranean, there's great contingency plans for the strikes. I mean, they have their targets. They've got the weapons prime, the Tomahawk missiles. All the ships are in the position they want in case there's any retaliation from any of the countries in the area, like the attacks on the 7th Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
They're prepared for everything. So they're planning this, which you'd say, well, that makes sense. We're going to attack a country, why don't we have a lot of plans?
You need to have a plan, right? Yeah, sure.
Here's the problem, according to Howard Friel. The Nuremberg Principles stipulate that crimes against peace, including the, quote, planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression or a war in violation of international treaties, agreements, or assurances. In his speech from the White House on Tuesday night, September 10th, Obama repeated an administration talking point that his threatened attacks on Syria involved plans and preparations to go beyond a pinprick attack. Thus, the president's apparent planning and preparation, incorporated as they are into illegal threats, may be a crime against peace under the Nuremberg Principles.
It's like a premeditated murder.
Well, this is said to be with the best of intentions. It's not to conquer territory. It's not Hitler going into Sudetenland in order to protect the Germans. I mean, everybody has a good reason to attack other countries, at least in the modern era. Nobody's
in their minds.
We want more land. You know, we want your oil. We want your
a good reason.
Slaves.
Yeah,
you know?
they don't say that.
They don't say that. So they always have to have some good reason. So, but and I'm sure, as a human being, everybody was horrified at the use of these weapons. And it's odd in that phrase now that I'm sure that President Obama regretted ever saying, crossing this red line with 100,000 people dead with conventional weapons and 1,000 or 1,500 dead from chemical weapons. It's suddenly the chemical deaths. And of course,
like take precedence or more
emotionally.
Yeah. It's scarier for people.
Yeah. Yeah, like they were used during World War One, and with the millions of soldiers killed, the numbers of one that died from the use of the different poison gases wasn't that great.
But they've been used in every war, haven't they? I mean, Vietnam, there was gas. And
they didn't. Well, it's interesting that depends on how you cut it. Agent Orange?
Yeah. That's a chemical.
Well, people are still dying or still having birth defects.
Vietnamese
is still getting birth defects. Our soldiers now in their 60s and 70s have
suffering
the effects. Sometimes they think they're children. All right. Listen, we just
they
been
think
talking
they're
about,
children?
No. They're children.
Oh.
The children and the offspring of people that were exposed
terrible.
To Agent Orange. Yeah, we've been just, this is all such a downer, we've just been talking such a downer. Let's talk about Detroit when we get back.
Oh, great. Let's lift it up.
All right. You can try calling in right now,
313. I'll take your calls.
Yeah, Jalene will take your call. Here's the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At GEICO.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit GEICO.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Guys, WRIF.com has everything you desire packed inside the Riff Man Cave. It's the online destination for all things manly. Babes, beer, sports, humor, and more. The Riff Man Cave, brought to you by ABC Harley-Davidson. Man up your desktop now at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bigger, badder. Wolf Hackier.
Wait, that's not a word.
WRIF Sin City Takeover 2013. Listen for your chance to join the Riff Wolf Pack in Vegas. Or get more details at WRIF.com.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, if you're ready to testify, it's our second hour, and our phones are open. I guess a couple of people got blown off, unfortunately. So
no,
call
and
back.
It was the phone's fault.
I know, that's what I mean.
These things have a mind of their own sometimes.
Yeah. And Jefferson is standing by to get your calls at 313-298-WRIF, which also is...
313-298-9743. Stop it,
get
Peter.
Get those candies out
Stop
of your
it,
mouth.
Peter.
Yeah. Hey, you can...
It's late. I work all day. It keeps me rolling through the show.
Email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My website is peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. Got a lot of emails here.
And why is it these phone issues always happen when we're on the air?
You sure it doesn't happen?
I mean, I know it happens other times, but it happens to us like all the time.
I've never heard, well, I've listened, you know, Dave and Chuck the Freak are kind of new in the morning.
I think it's a conspiracy.
It is. All right. Winston Smith writes in and says, I voted for Obama only because the alternative was McCain. But that was 08. But I think it's about time we openly acknowledge that Mr. Obama is more than just a disappointment. He's turned out to be a little more than an articulate version of Bush. You know, on a lot of domestic,
I don't agree with that.
Internationally, all imperial presidencies are going to be very similar. Although I said that, believe it, if it would have been President Romney, we would be bombing Syria without a doubt, and all the Republicans would be
pro-war,
way back in there. Yeah. Let's see here. Let me see if I can get this one up. George from Taylor. He writes in. Here's a quote from John Kenneth Galbraith, President Franklin Roosevelt's economist of the 1930s, but still applies to Republicans today. He says, quote, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness.
Ooh.
Some of them would agree, because that was the horrid Ayn Rand's deal, selfishness. She thought that was good. Sort of Adam Smithish, this 18th century economist who said, if we each seek our own advantage under capitalism, the common good will be realized.
Boy,
of course,
the exact opposite.
Yeah, well, exact
we
opposite. Right. It's the melting pot, right?
Yes.
People on the bottom get burned and the scum rise to the top.
Right, that. But the way we're more of a, we're like a hippie commune kind of an attitude. Let's all get along.
John writes in thoughts about 9/11. No, little mention of that. 12 years ago, probably still etched in all our memories.
Yeah, this was this Tuesday. Past week. Yeah.
Think about this though. If you were 12 or 13 when this occurred, you're 25. If you're 25 now, you were 12 or 13 when that occurred.
Yeah.
So it's receding. And John, like so many other people, he says, I still don't believe the official story. I don't know if you've addressed this lately.
No. Have we seen Zeitgeist? Yes.
Yeah. It's very strange that most of our warplanes were conveniently on the West Coast. I don't know. Hard to say. The official story doesn't make sense. All the conspiracy stories don't either. So I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, you redeemed yourself there.
I don't know where that leaves us. Let's see. And hear from Stephen in Farmington Hills. George Zimmerman back in the news again. Can you believe this guy? And
situation. George Zimmerman taken into custody after a big old scuffle with his father-in-law and his wife who was leaving him. And it was because his wife, who was leaving him, was accusing him of having an affair, which
right.
There's apparently quite a bit of photographic evidence of said affair, and threatening the wife with the gun, punching his father-in-law, her father, in the nose, and he was in his truck, and he had the gun, and he was looking at her, and he said, come closer, come closer.
Now, I wonder, some of you people that were so enthusiastic about this murderer, who were making all the excuses for this grown man with this pistol, killing this unarmed teenager who had no history of violence, and with this man who is obviously a sandwich short of a picnic, right?
Who has
this history of violence.
And anger, and domestic violence.
Domestic violence. Didn't he? There was something to do with the police at one time as well. And none of that was allowed to be brought in.
Right. And when she called 911, she said, I'm really, really afraid. I don't know what he's capable of. This is his own wife. And she has said that he's a very angry individual. Do you think?
Yeah.
And now what are you people who supported George Zimmerman, what are you saying now? Do you think that this was just an isolated incident? Is there maybe more of a possibility in your mind that he killed Trayvon Martin?
And executed him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
God, this really got me going when I read it.
You know, we said we were going to talk about Detroit. I want to take these callers. If you're online,
we'll
get them. But we said we were going to talk about Detroit.
And we will.
And we will, but Pauline and also Briggs has written into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Says, what do you guys think about the emergency manager appointee shutting off the power in Detroit on 9/11 without warning to teach them a lesson?
Okay, I just, Polly, who's one of our listeners, sent me something about that. I can't get online here.
Is Polly and Pauline the same person?
Oh, yeah, that's Polly, yeah.
Okay. And so did Briggs as well. And it went out again. Wasn't it on Friday, I think, as well? It was one of those days, my wife and I, we were coming from downtown Detroit, and we're looking down these streets, no streetlights.
And they said it was because of the heat and everyone using their AC on Tuesday.
We're going to have to take a look at
that. Into this a little more.
Okay. Here is, I'm sorry, I don't have the name here, but hi, you're on the air from the Outback. Hello.
No. Who?
What? I hear some.
I think it's, you know who.
No, it's not, but I hear.
Yes.
Are you with us?
Put him on hold, Peter. Stop it! Move on! You're like a little kid sometimes.
Here's Larry in Gratiot. Larry, there's a city called Gratiot?
No, town.
Town. All right. Well, that works. Okay. I didn't know there was a town called Gratiot. Is it on Gratiot Avenue? Oh, Fort Gratiot. I've heard of that. Yeah, sure. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I was just wondering if they're going to actually go through with the bombing and stuff.
Well, it looks like Obama has found a way out of there just through a slip of the tongue by Secretary of State Kerry, who said if they gave up all their chemical weapons, they wouldn't do it. And I think with these many Americans, with the number of Americans that are opposed to the bombing, I think he is looking for any way to get out of it. And I think all of us who have opposed it have really, Larry, made history. This is the first time that a war has been stopped in advance by the American people saying no.
Larry, what do you think, Larry?
That's really shocking that they're really stopping it.
Did you want them to stop it?
I really care less, but I do have family that are in the military, so I do kind of care about it. So I really don't want them to go over there and go against the war again.
Yeah, that happened bad last time, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then, you know, so that's, I totally get that. But think about all the families in these countries and these people that were innocently killing, you know, these civilians who have nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. Remember, think about this. I always think, say there were, we were, became really a weak country. And China had some beef with us, and they said, we're going to take out all the weapons around Detroit. And, you know, you're out there in Fort Gratiot. And,
well, good luck, first of all.
Yeah. And we were just kind of waiting for these missiles to hit.
To happen, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Larry, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's the guy from the Outback. Hi, you're on the air.
All right. Peter, just hang up on this person.
I like he hung up himself.
The
I got rid of him
you
by
did.
Mistake. No, I wanted to,
the breather.
He, you know, he had foot pains.
Oh, I shouldn't be okay. So, well, he asked. He has a pain in his left foot. What should he do? Okay, and I'm not being even facetious. I'm being quite serious about it. Go to the doctor.
Here's what I would do before you go to a doctor. And because a lot of our listeners are younger people and not people that are not in the highest paying jobs, don't have health plans and all that. It's all going to be available to people now. Beginning next month, the Obamacare is going to click in. But one of the things you can do, here's what I do. I use the method of Dr. Howard Schubiner.
Oh, I knew you were going here.
And you
but
can,
that's good.
You can go to his website, unlearnyourpain.com. Unlearnyourpain.com. He thinks that a lot of the pains we suffer have emotional roots. And
it's mind-body.
Mind-body stuff. And I, okay. Real quick story. We're entering into league play with my handball crew, right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, probably 3-4 dozen guys are going to be playing handball. Last week, suddenly, my back people say, my back went out, whatever
yeah.
the hell that means, right?
You had a lot of pain.
I had a lot of pain, and I began thinking about this, and I was really looking forward to it. I got a new partner. I think we could do well in our division and all of this. I want it so bad.
You do.
Yeah,
you
I
are
do.
So funny.
I know. But that would mean I couldn't play. And I started thinking about that because, you know, as much as enjoyable to play, there's always issues about competition.
Well, you get nervous and worked up.
Well, not even nervous. I mean, it sort of brings up a lot of issues. Competition does that.
Mm-hmm.
So I did some of these actually mental exercises that Dr. Schubiner suggested. It went away. Completely away.
You got a massage, too, didn't you?
Don't tell my wife.
Oh, stop it.
No, I didn't get a massage. She wasn't available.
Oh, so really?
Because I didn't need it.
So it worked.
Actually, she's PO'd at me because she thought I was going to do it, and then I didn't need it. It went away completely. So that's unlearnyourpain.com. And you would be astounded at what Dr. Schubiner says the mind-body syndrome tension myositis syndrome is. Tension myositis syndrome. That everything from most back and neck pains, TMJ, you know, stuff with
your
jaw.
Man, I have some serious issues then.
Well, people don't like to face this. I've told people.
Grinding the teeth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that I've had people say, look, I'm going to get this serious back
surgery.
And I say, why don't you go see Dr. Schubiner? He'll look at your x-rays and he might tell you, yeah, you need an operation.
Yeah,
you need to go to an orthopedic guy.
Fused discs or something.
Yeah. But it can't, the worst that Dr. Schubiner can do is nothing. Yeah. And rather than someone sticking a knife in your back.
Oh, yeah.
Another friend of mine, I interviewed him as well, a Dr. Kirsch, who is head of the Harvard University's division of placebo medicine.
Oh, wow, cool.
And can you believe this? They actually did these knee operations where, I don't know how they got volunteers with it. Half of them had this operation.
The procedure.
The procedure, and the other half just had an incision and then sewed up. And the recovery rate was identical. Some of the people that got the surgery didn't get any better. Some of the people that didn't have the surgery but thought they did got better.
See? Yeah. Well, that says a lot right there. I do believe in that, in the power of the mind in so many ways.
Well, people believe that. If you think, I'm so tense, I have a headache, you believe, you know, you certainly believe it. For instance, Dr. Schubiner says whiplash, that people had a car accident and had soft tissue damage.
Yes.
5 years later, he says there's no way in the world you could still have pain there. What is it? But he says you have pain there because there are these neurological memories, these pathways that reproduce the pain you experience. So his site of unlearnyourpain.com used to be called Your Pain is Real, because he wanted to assure them that he knew that they were in
pain.
In
that
great
he
pain.
Wasn't just saying you're faking it or you're making this up.
There's now an illness that they don't know what the cause of it is, called fibromyalgia, that particularly women suffer. 50, 60 years ago, there were virtually no reporting of it. Now millions of women have this.
Yeah.
And you go to Howard's website. I call him Howard because he's a friend of mine. and unlearnyourpain.com. And well, by the way, you say, oh, yeah, does he have a, you know, a storefront and sell little bottles of meth? He has a clinic. His mind-body clinic is at Providence Hospital. He's a highly respected doctor, won all sorts of awards, does all this research on...
I find it fascinating. Yeah, anyway, we have some open lines if you would like to call about anything. 313-298-9743.
All right, and here's Jim. Jim's in Rochester. Jim, thanks for your patience and for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks for my patience. I enjoy the show very much.
Yeah. I may not be a doctor, but I'm losing my patience. Go ahead.
And thanks for being patient. Hanging on the line.
What I wanted to say was I'm just very disappointed. Like, you know, when Obama got elected back in 08, and it was just like it kind of was new hope, and I thought, like, okay, yeah, it really is. I mean, the first semi-black president or whatever he is. But now I just, that's all
semi-black.
I feel about him. you know what I mean? It's like, is he black? I don't know. But it's like,
his mother was white and his father was African-American, so he's biracial.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what we say now. You know, the only reason the color would, that he would be called black is because we live in a society that still has pretty strict racial definitions, because you would think that someone could, people shouldn't even, go ahead. Let's not get into it. Go ahead.
Right. No, and it was cool. And I was really excited. And I don't vote either one. I don't, you know, it seems like it's the same old stuff, and now we're going into another country.
Well, that's what I said a little earlier. As long as you have a military-industrial complex, as long as you have an American empire, it isn't going to matter which president from which party is going to be in power. Sooner or later, they're going to be involved in some military adventure.
Somewhere,
except if the American people do what we did this time. And 73% of us, Republicans and Democrats and independents and Nazis and socialists and, you know, left, right, center, literally, all races, all religions, all said no.
Yeah.
So
the American people were finally fed up with, two in a row like that, losing... Even if they didn't care about the people over there, they cared about our troops and, you know.
So what the real, as the phrase goes now, what the real takeaway from this is that at some times there actually is power of the people. That if we exercise it,
throughout history.
Yeah, it wasn't even much of an exercise. But people, they just took polls.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't even have to go out in the streets. Nobody had to do much activity.
But people were in the streets.
They were. Yeah, and that's an important part of it. But I'm not disappointed in Obama, because I didn't think he was going to be any different than he is. In Europe, you know, they have the left, the center, and the right. And and Obama, for all practical purposes, in Britain or Italy or France, would be a center rightist. He wouldn't even be considered a leftist by any, maybe not even in Canada.
And over here, people are have been up in, you know, in a frothing at the mouth, socialism, you know, gosh, what is up with this country?
So but if there wouldn't be Barack Obama, there wouldn't be this beginnings of a national health program. I mean, as flawed as it is, flawed because of Republican recalcitrance. Let me put it this way. Let's go to the negatives. You could take any issue in American, any, you know, facing us now from the environment and women's rights, civil liberties, you know, awful on civil liberties, prosecuting whistleblowers and mm-hmm. leakers and all that, and say we're disappointed on each of them. Pardon me. But
now you talked about Howard Schubiner.
Yeah, right.
Clearing your throat.
Clearing my throat. You think that's okay?
Yeah.
But in, I guess the alternative would have been so catastrophically awful. Are both parties behooven to Wall Street? Yeah, indeed. Is Barack Obama a little less? The Democrats a little less? Yeah. Right now we have to settle for a little less. And the reason we can't get what we want is because we keep depending on people to do it for us. And, you know, okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. All of a sudden, you think that's it? I got
I do.
I got the major tickle in my throat. All right, here what I was going to talk about Detroit. This is pretty interesting. A Free Press investigation. How Detroit went broke. The answers may surprise you, it says, and don't blame Coleman Young.
There and is, I missed this because I haven't read the paper yet.
Yeah. There is this, what I call the dominant white narrative. That is what white people tell each other about what went wrong with Detroit. Well, Detroit was, and we've gone through this before, Detroit was this wonderful city. Everybody was happy. There was no crime. And then Coleman Young got elected, told white people to get out of Detroit. Black people rioted. And then Kwame Kilpatrick came in and stole millions. And the union screwed everything up by wanting too many benefits.
You know what's amazing about that? Is so many people believe all of that.
Forgetting about the fact that, of course, that the riots in 1967 occurred prior to the election of Coleman Young.
Yes.
Forgetting about that Coleman Young never, ever told white
never
people to
that.
Get out of Detroit. In fact, he was, if at that time when Detroit was becoming a majority African-American city, he was actually, if he was telling anybody to get out of Detroit, he was telling black criminals to get out. He said, if you're a criminal, hit 8 Mile Road. In other words, he was going to increase police repression of criminality.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, how did people get this idea? Because he said something that made them think that.
No. Oh, well, he was...
It was a speech.
He was an arrogant son of a bitch without... I mean, and, you know, in the 1940s, late 1940s, there was this committee of the House, of the House of Representatives, called the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to Detroit investigating communist influence in the unions because essentially it was run by Southerners because the whole Democratic Party, the Southern racists that were blacks weren't allowed to vote and, you know, for a long, long time.
Yes.
Were run by these Southern white Democrats. And so they were anti-union, anti-black, anti-everything. And you know what happened when finally
nice guys.
When finally civil rights was achieved to some extent in the South, all the white races went to the Republican Party. But anyway, so these this House Un-American Activities Committee came to Detroit, and among other people, they called Coleman Young, who was in many ways close to people in the Communist Party because the Communist Party actually in the 1930s and 1940s, before they pretty much were expelled, organized a lot of the unions, the old the UAW, the CIO, all these unions mm-hmm. like that. So he stood up to them to such a point that his testimony was recorded on a 78 RPM record.
What?
And was a bestseller in the black areas, which were then were a complete ghetto. And
no, I think I remember hearing about that as an interview. Yeah. Who has one of those?
I don't know. It's I have there was a book that my old pal Bill McGraw from the Detroit Free Press put together with headlines from the Detroit Free Press. In fact, similes of the paper, and there's a whole account of it.
Yeah.
And you know, and Coleman Young had a lisp. Of some sort.
Okay.
And there was, I did hear this because they asked him to name names and he said, you must have me confused with a stool pigeon.
Oh, God. Now don't make fun of people who stutter or have a lisp.
And then he headed something, I'm trying to remember all this, the Negro Labor Congress or council. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it was national or just in Detroit. And that was the phrase that was used, you know, colored people and Negro was what was used during that period. So black and African American.
Well, some people still use it, sadly.
Yeah. And so the Southerner, the Southern congressman asked him, except he said the word, and I'm not, don't get crazy because I'm not going to finish it the way
I won't.
He spelled it N-I-G-R-A.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I have trouble. I can't even say that.
No, me neither.
I mean, we can say words, but I don't want to say that.
No.
And he kept, and Coleman Young kept saying, what are you saying? And he kept saying, and he got right in his face, and finally he said, I can't help it. I'm from the South, you know, the congressman.
Because people use that word.
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of a combination of the N-word and Negro.
Jeez, these ignorant people.
You know, I'm always laughing because they're, you know, we have a lot of African American listeners, and they're probably these white people.
I know, you know they are.
I know.
We relate. We understand.
We're true. Anyway, let's go back to Detroit Free Press investigation: how Detroit went broke. Well, guess when it began? Not under Coleman Young, not under Kwame Kilpatrick, but they put it back to Albert Cobo. And the only thing that most of us know about Cobo
is a hall.
Yeah. And it was also the deindustrialization of Detroit, and things began to go south, and there was, you know, the attempt to maintain wage standards and services then led to the introduction of a city income tax, which people said, why, let's get out of here. Mayor, one of the things that Mayor Cobo did, who was the mayor between 1950 and 1957, he was all about creating these freeways, which in conjunction with the suburban builders allowed people to get out of the city, which was crowded, had smaller lots, and people said, oh, Roseville, Warren,
yes.
Oak Park, you know, this is Southgate, this is real nice. So the city, for a lot of reasons, began to empty out and be left with a predominantly poor population that, because of racism, was predominantly black. So then it's easy for white people to say, oh, black people did it. Hey, it was really rich guys in suits, you know,
and
politicians, developers.
Because people ask me this all the time. Yeah. And
well, they, you know, there was more money to be made by letting Detroit go down the drain. I mean, Coleman Young actually got high marks both from business, from business and from political observers, because he actually began a process of trying to bring a budget of Detroit into, fit it up with what the revenues were, but never got anywhere.
So did these white people, take the businesses out of downtown, or?
Well, it wasn't just it happened to all the big cities that there was this urban sprawl. And one of the things, and the real people to blame are the auto industry, who, in order to maximize profits, wanted to escape union wages, which essentially created our middle class in this area. And they began moving, not to China, not to Mexico, but to Alabama and Georgia.
Tennessee.
Like that. Yeah, where they could have non-union shops, and instead of paying, say, then, I don't know, it could have been $3.75 an hour, they could pay $1.75 an hour. And so people lost jobs. This is at the point where there was, you know, high unemployment in the African-American community. They had good wages. They had good benefits. But then when some of the companies began moving out, there was no public transportation. And there was also what they called redlining, which was a real estate deal where white real estate and developers wouldn't allow black people. It was segregation.
God.
So there was no way that people in the inner city could get to the jobs, and there was no way they could buy houses, out there.
Anywhere else.
Yeah. But it's interesting is that the two evil characters in all of this, Coleman Young, is rated actually one of the...
And you evil's in quotes, by the way, if you just tuned in.
And Kwame Kilpatrick, of course, a corrupt, arrogant guy who at first was highly thought of and an innovative young politician that...
Well, he had a legacy to follow, his mother.
Yeah. Right, which he sunk the whole family.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we are where we are, and no one wants to see this as a failure of the system. That even to blame it on Albert Cobo or Louis Mariani or Jerome Kavanaugh, if you don't know who those are, the mayors that go back into the 1950s and the 1960s. Roman Gribbs.
What did Cobo do?
Kobo was the guy who, like, for one thing...
I mean, what was his part in this?
He was the one that was all about creating these freeways. I mean,
I got all confused.
Yeah, we all love the freeways, and you'd think now just... I mean, it was sort of a modern...
innovative?
Innovation, yeah, to be sure. Let's see here in the Free Press. With the U.S. economy booming and the automakers dominating... Kobo ran Detroit at the city's peak, more than 1.8 million. He engineered 20 miles of expressways crisscrossing Detroit, which, of course, destroyed neighborhoods. That's one of the things that freeways...
went right through them, yeah.
Yeah, just destroyed the cohesiveness
paved
of them.
Paved paradise and
put up a parking lot. Yeah. Highways siphoned away population eager for larger yards and quieter streets in the suburbs. Plans soon were drawn for more freeways in Detroit. Construction that lasted into the 1970s and destroyed some established black neighborhoods. He laid the groundwork for the Civic Center, helped the city avoid bankruptcy. So that was already a threat way 20 years before Coleman Young and 30 or 40 before Kwame Kilpatrick. Louis Mariani was the next guy, 57 to 62. He was indicted for income tax evasion and served a one-year...
Oops.
Yeah, oops, like that. Jerome Kavanaugh tried some stuff, including, I think he was the one that put in the first city tax. Maybe not. But anyway, so then it goes on to Coleman Young. He became Detroit's first African-American mayor, but when he took over the economic climate in the country... and the city loaded his plate with problems. So this is what he inherited.
Yeah.
Coleman Young faced this. The auto industry plagued by rising fuel prices and cars with lousy mileage and also lousy cars.
Yeah.
And plus they are moving out. Made worse by steep U.S. inflation, Young laid off employees and campaigned for tax increases, which was actually because he wanted to meet these budgets. People say, tax increases, we hate these. Well, sometimes you got to go for it. People continued to leave. Young wooed white business establishment, was a close political ally of Republican Governor William Milliken. He presided over the opening of the Renaissance Center, the building of the Detroit Hamtramck GM Assembly Plant, and Chrysler's Jefferson North Assembly Plant. Not that those didn't have its problem, like the Hamtramck plant, the Detroit Hamtramck GM Assembly Plant, destroyed this Polish neighborhood. So, I mean, he, like we were saying about Obama, acted like a Republican, the GM, and he was buddies with all these guys. They saw in him somebody that was capable of managing. But there was, I mean, ultimately, this is a failure of the entire economic system. Because let's say that everybody made mistakes, white mayors, black mayors, unions, non-unions,
okay,
real estate developers, and what have you. So what do you do? You just screw everybody, particularly people that have worked their butt off all their years as a bus driver, sanitation worker, and something, strip them of their pension?
Well, what's going on now.
And
they're trying to make up for it with these payments.
I didn't bring the front page of the New York Times. These Wall Street speculators, they're the next way to fleece everybody is to, they're selling these, it's too complicated to...
Selling air again? Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, they're selling futures and credits, for ethanol. Don't ask.
Does this have to do with fracking?
No.
Okay.
Don't ask even. But they're making, hundreds
of
millions of billions.
Corn, right?
Yeah. But they're doing this and they're not providing anything. They're getting extraordinarily wealthy. In fact, I'm looking at the clock. We got to take a break right now. But we'll talk a little more about what's happening in the economy when we get back.
You know, quit doing that.
Most people, when you talk about the economy, think, what a snore.
Yeah,
who cares?
Know what? People are more concerned about the economy more than ever these days.
You're right.
And we lay it out in a way that makes a little more sense.
All right. Ray Bang, I'll also tell you about the guests we're going to have at 1 a.m.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Business owners and professionals face special challenges in divorce court. In addition to everything else going on, they have to contend with allegations that they are earning more than they are, coupled with claims on their business or practices themselves.
Attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
An effective defense often hinges on subtle and sophisticated strategies, on things such as business valuations, income allocations, and tax income projections. Clients with assets depend on their divorce lawyer's skills in these matters, and that's why it's so important to hire someone that has those skills.
The domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell is the partner men can count on, particularly in the face of complex litigation. Cordell & Cordell, offering sophisticated solutions for men in divorce. 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor. 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
Attention business owners, this is Tony Robbins. I've spent the last 3 decades helping companies create serious business breakthroughs, and I want to help you like never before.
And this is Chet Holmes, author of the number one business book, The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you've heard my radio spots before, maybe you don't know that about 2,000 action-oriented business owners call us every week to get our free reports. But it was Tony Robbins that challenged me to go even further for you.
Chet and I have built a serious training program called 4 Ways to Double Sales in 12 Months.
And here's what Tony convinced me to do.
We're going to give this to any business owner who calls us at 800-936-0222. Just call with your email address and we'll email you this phenomenal audio training program at our expense, not yours.
It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months.
Call and leave us a voicemail with your email and we'll give you a program that others have paid dearly to receive. Call right now. That's 1-800-936-0222.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Jeez, Kim. It's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. So if you want to get your voice heard on WRIF, time to do it. Jefferson, yes. Waiting for your call. We didn't start off well because we kept you off the phone for the first hour, but now is the time. Hey, we were talking a lot about Syria, and Stephen Zunas, professor of politics and chair of the Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco, who I've had on any number of times, is going to be talking about the ongoing Syria crisis. That's at 1 a.m., or I haven't decided which one I will play first. Or Marion Nestle, who wrote this book called Eat, Drink, Vote, and talking about how food politics determines what we eat. I mean, actually, you were saying, wait a minute, I choose what we eat. I eat, you know?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. I mean,
you really
some
don't. I mean, you got to look a little further into it. Monsanto chooses what you eat a lot of the time.
Yeah. Actually, I think I'm going to play her first.
Okay.
Because we've been pretty heavy on the politics. And
we always are, but you mean on Syria alone.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah. And this is all political anyway. Actually,
everything's political. My friend said that even brushing your teeth is political. So there you go.
Okay.
What toothpaste you choose is political.
Anyway, there'll be a podcast available at noon today, Monday. And thank you, Jefferson, and also Jeremy for making this happen.
Yeah.
Although, you know, we could, I don't know. What did we say we're going to talk about?
Well, I know. Zimmerman, but we covered that.
Forget about Zimmerman. This is, Well, new low for government trust, the figures are in. But, you know, it's odd. Democrats have far more confidence in government than Republicans. 78% of Democrats trust the government on international issues. Democrats, what is with you?
Yeah, really?
Yeah. compared to just 35% of Republicans. Oh, but I suspect if there would have been President Romney and this identical stuff was going on, well, I mean, he would have bombed Syria already. And then we would have been loading up the troops to go invade. The Republicans.
Well, we got all those guys back and women back from Iraq. I mean, they're free, right?
Yeah. It's not like
that's what they probably think.
There's no jobs for them, anything like that.
Might as well keep them busy, right?
Yeah. Here's the one I was looking for, though. The income gap between the wealthy 1%. Now, what would you think? 1%. I would think on the face of it, these were people that would make like $10 to $20 million a year or more, right? To be in the 1%, all you have to make is $394,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in showbiz, hey, we know people that are making that. Not very many in radio anymore.
Well, but we know people are making triple that in radio.
We do.
Yeah, we just do. We'll leave it at that.
We don't want to go there. Right. But you only have to have to be in the 1%, $394,000. Actually, these figures are escaping me, but 80% of the population earns something like less than $55,000 a year or more.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so what's happening, though, is that the income gap between the wealthiest 1% and everyone else is the widest since 1927, according to a new University of California study. 1927. Why does that year stick in my mind? What happened the next year?
What was it, Peter?
Was that when Charles Lindbergh? No, that wasn't. Oh, it was the Great Depression. The Great
Crash. Right. That little thing.
Partly what it was, there was underconsumption, is that people just didn't have any money.
To spend, yeah.
To spend. And the productive apparatus was going right ahead. So that happened.
That's going on now. People don't have the money to spend.
Another, in fact, the study's calling Striking It Richer, the Evolution of Top Incomes in the United States. Breaking another record, the top 10% of earners took in a level higher than any other year since 1917 and even surpasses 1928, the peak of the stock market bubble in the roaring 20s. Now, the other, what we call, say it for me, please.
I don't know what you're trying to say.
Dominant narrative.
I didn't know where you were going at all.
Is they say, well, they earned it.
Yes,
yeah.
We hear that.
You earned it, and you didn't get rewarded very well. They didn't earn it because all they did was buy futures on ethanol or some big stock market or real estate bubble and made money on their money.
They pressed a button on their computer.
Yeah. They created a situation partly through technology where productivity has increased greatly, so they get more money per unit produced. But you and I don't share in it at all. I mean, I don't produce units. So the top 1% incomes captured just over 2/3 of the overall economic growth of real incomes over the last 20 years. Over the last 20 years. And on the other hand, too, the top 1%, their income has grown more than 31%, while the income of the bottom 99%, which includes the top 10%, grew not even 1%.
Now, wait a minute.
Is that not too many figures?
Yes.
Okay.
You said which includes, you said the bottom, which includes the top.
The bottom 99% also includes, well, between 90% and 99%.
Okay.
Right, I didn't,
Thank you.
You're right. So if you took that away, there is actually a net loss between the 89th percentile and down, which is probably 95% of the American people.
So, so your bottom line is...
The rich are getting richer, and everyone else is either treading water or doing worse, mostly doing worse. So it's, and people, I don't know, people don't get mad anymore, maybe because they realize this is true.
Are they beaten down?
This is a system that has always been based on looting. And I'm not saying you loot anybody, or if your dad owns a business, you know, a little shop he owns, he's a looter.
Right.
But first off, let's get real. The country was looted from the native people, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The original wealth, the great accumulation of wealth, was created through the looting of slaves from Africa.
Yes.
The great industrial wealth was looted from the ordinary working people who worked 12 and 14 hours a day in mines and factories under the worst conditions.
Horrible conditions.
Who just died, you know, when they were 33 and what have you. And then a lot of the wealth and the resources has been looted through from the rest of the world. So, I mean, what does that say? Does that make you a bad person or me a bad person? No. But it makes, but when you look at the definitions of a system, maybe that's not the one that we want to continue, particularly when it's filled with wars, economic, and environmental degradation.
Yeah, corruption in general.
Corruption, we can do better than this.
Sure can.
All right, let's go to Mike. Mike's in Clyde. What?
Click it.
Click it. Yeah, click it or ticket.
I'm going to give you a ticket.
Yeah, all right. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Welcome. What's up?
Okay. Oh, hey, I just never hear enough about anymore about fracking because I talk to a lot of people who have no idea what it is or what's going on.
Yes.
And
we were just talking about that, natural gas, and I saw this commercial earlier on television tonight, Mike. It was so disgusting. It was these farmers, they're like, we've been farming this land for 65 years, and it's been our family for blah, blah, blah. We have Black Angus cows, and it shows these rolling green hills and these cows grazing, and then they show their big fracking machine that they have. And we, I don't know what they said, something, drill or whatever, for natural gas. And
they made
it look so beautiful, you know?
Yeah. But tell people what fracking is, Mike.
Basically, they're taking a bunch of our fresh water, putting a bunch of chemicals in it, pumping it into the ground and polluting it, and then getting oil or gas back out.
Which the water supply is poisoned.
Yeah, they can, there's an incredible, documentary. If you have HBO, it's available there. There's Gasland and then Gasland 2. And one of the things they show is people lighting, their water on fire coming out of the faucet because it's filled with methane gas. So,
well, we went to a conference for the township and basically was told that state regulation says that no township can make any zoning affecting fracking.
Really? Well, you know, there is a statewide, I should be doing more with this and have this on my website, which I don't. There is a statewide campaign to put fracking on the ballot. And
that's cool.
Well, you know, here's what's the problem with that, and I told these folks, in fact, one of them stayed at our house earlier this year, and that when there's been attempts to, by referendum, have things against logging of old-growth forests, or I'm trying to think of other things like that, but these corporations come in, stuff with mining waste into streams out west, these mining companies, and these gas companies, they'll come in, you know, we'll raise $210,000, and they'll raise $20
million. Oh, yeah.
And because I'm sure you and everyone else has seen these ads that talk about the supply of natural gas, that we can end foreign dependence.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. And so just that, see, they're heading off. They're already anticipating challenges to what fracking does.
They're lying
does.
To people and setting them up for it.
I mean, it's whatever. You know, they're getting ready for the battle, and they're already have spent tens of millions of dollars on advertising to the point where people say, hey, getting natural gas from Michigan?
And yeah, it's better than the Middle East, right?
Yeah, they wouldn't, no more wars because we wouldn't care about their oil. We wouldn't keep being shedding blood for oil.
Whatever, we're still going to be, don't buy into it. We're still going to be doing that very thing while we're doing this.
That's right.
But not we, they.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, the scary thing is a lot of people I talk to none of them even know what fracking is.
Well,
I'd say at least 60 to 70% of the people never heard of it.
Well, you know what? Most Americans, I'm not being mean or anything, but most Americans are a little slow on the uptake when it comes to things like this, just like they were slow on the uptake when it came to the realities of Iraq.
Yeah. All right, Mike, but, yeah, you're...
We'll keep talking about it.
We'll keep talking about it, and...
And you keep talking about it.
That's right. You know, this is not something that I probably should bring up now. You're going, what now? Because, no,
why must you say things like that?
It's another health issue, and this is something that I brought up to Dave and Chuck the Freak. There was a demonstration on Saturday at Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak against circumcision. Pardon me.
Against circumcision, okay.
Yeah, because now...
What's their argument?
Oh, my, this is amazing. Well, for one thing, is that Michigan has the second highest rate of circumcision in the nation at 85%, which most people would say, yeah, isn't that good? Isn't that what guys, are little babies, are supposed to...
I think it's mean. I remember when my nephew had it done, I was horrified. I mean, I didn't watch it, but just that they took him away to do that to him. That's the first thing you do to a baby after they come out is
cut his wee-wee.
Well, and that's painful. That's got to be painful.
Yeah, well,
I don't
even have one, and it hurts me to think about it. Well, you know, there was actually this doctor that was doing circumcisions, and because, you know, this is baby foreskin, how soft it was, so they found out that he was making these little change purses.
Gross!
Really?
Peter!
And then, but if you kissed it, it turned into a full-size suitcase.
You did not! You did not do that!
All right.
God.
Let's go back to this.
Peter!
The national hospital circumcision rate has tended downwards towards around 20%, which I didn't know at all. Routine infant circumcision costs Michigan insurance companies over $11 million a year that could be spent on necessary medical care, they say.
It's gone down 20% or down to 20%?
It has, nationally, has gone down to 20%. That's amazing.
That can't be true. Everyone I know who has a boy baby has their child circumcised.
Do they? All right.
Yes.
The West Coast has far fewer circumcisions with a rate of around 20%.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I think that's good. I think maybe some of your men's problems is because you were circumcised right out of the womb.
I don't have this problem.
You should see his face right now.
You don't even know which way I'm going.
I know you're right.
Okay.
I wasn't talking about you.
Okay. Oh, you're talking to the audience. Jen Damouche, let's see, what's her name? Jen Damouche, co-director of Intact, INTACT. I like
okay.
that. With so much attention spent on eliminating unnecessary health care expenses, it seems logical that one of the first things to go would be cosmetic surgery performed on infants.
It really kind of is. I mean, honestly, without going into too much detail, it kind of is.
You know, that is interesting. There's a number of people across the world that do circumcision, have ritual circumcision, Jews and I think Muslims at the birth. But there's also in some primitive tribes, they do it as a rite of passage at manhood.
Oh, they do it, when
like
they're
12, 13 years old or something like that. Yeah.
Wow. That's rough.
One of the main reasons that circumcision persists in the United States is that doctors are failing to obtain truly informed consent from parents. Ignorance about the purpose and function of the human foreskin, coupled with a desire for easy money, is driving the negligence to properly inform vulnerable new moms and dads about the real risks and long-term harm of circumcision. You know, this is nothing I've thought about greatly, but I have to say that of all of the
concerns?
So, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm
health concerns.
I've been at the Y. I've been at you know, LA Fitness where I play handball and all.
You've
that.
Been at the Schwitz.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you're not supposed to stare at other guys' wee-wees, but you know,
sometimes the peripheral yeah. is undeniable.
And all and almost, I mean, all of everybody, at least
I think
in Michigan,
this is the most talkative I've been all night. Go ahead.
Yeah, are circumcised, and I don't know that they're suffering any real thing. But if it doesn't serve any function. What is, and they say the foreskin serves to protect the body from contaminants, preserves sensitivity in the mucosa that contains immunological function, as well as provide normal sexual stimulation during intercourse to both man and his partner. In infancy, the foreskin covers and protects the opening of the body, the urethra, and fights infection.
God, this is a little much information for me. Go ahead, though.
It's beginning to kind of...
the creep. Are you getting feeling weird
yeah.
right now?
Yeah.
Do you think... Why did I even end the show with this?
Well,
they used to say it was a cleanliness issue.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's where it kind of came from.
It did.
But I don't know. I say just quit scarring the children.
Yeah. What do they say? But that's
Leave
interesting.
Leave the baby boys alone.
Infant cosmetic surgery.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe we'll bring it up first thing next time.
let's do a whole show dedicated to it.
Oh, but
2 hours.
Dave and Chuck the Freak, our morning show, were going to go to the demonstration, but then they found out it was on Saturday.
Oh, well, maybe they still sent an intern or something.
Well, they were going to send their producer, James. You know James?
Yeah, well, I know of, yeah.
Yeah, and but I don't know. Never on Saturday.
Never on Saturday? Why not?
They don't work then. It's a day off. It's time for us to go, too.
Clearly.
Yeah.
We've gone downhill... Rapidly, we apologize.
Syria is a circumcision. Yeah.
Hey, you know what, though? I'm just joking about that because we cover everything
yeah.
here.
Including?
What was that? I don't know what that hand signal is because at all, we have some hand signals in here, but that's
here.
A new one.
We are out of here. All right. And Seth, we're going to have to take care of you next week. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening, everybody. And Jefferson, thanks for getting back here. And we'll take your calls next week. Stay tuned. We've got great interviews ahead.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Divorce is never an easy decision, nor should it be. You didn't get married to get divorced, and if your thinking is right, you won't choose divorce when good alternatives exist. Having said that, if you're a man facing divorce, you should know that, like many things in life, timing is important. Too often guys find themselves in a divorce court when their businesses are thriving, when their investments are appreciating, and their income soaring. Not surprisingly, these conditions tend to produce more painful property divisions and richer support orders. The reverse is typically true when men are in less favorable financial circumstances, when their assets and their ability to pay are diminished. My point is simply this. Divorce may make the most sense for men when they can least afford it. Think about it.
Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bigger, badder, wolf hackier.
Wait, that's not a word.
WRIF Sin City Takeover 2013. Listen for your chance to join the Rip Wolf Pack in Vegas. Or get more details at WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I bet I know your favorite food. It probably has fat, salt, and sugar in it, or all three of them, like in a donut or something like that. And doesn't that almost, just this mention of it makes your kind of mouth water and all that, doesn't it? Lurking in the back of our mind, though, we know that's not the best stuff for us, and we ought to limit fats and salt and sugar and what have you. But the United States is not exactly the healthiest country in the world, and I don't even know if there are healthy countries any longer in terms of what foods they eat. The fat, salt, sugar has probably conquered the world. Well, we should talk about food, and a wonderful book has come my way. It's written by Marion Nessel, and Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, that's New York University. She's also a professor of sociology there, a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell, written several award-winning books, including What to Eat. She writes a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle and blogs almost daily at foodpolitics.com. It's a pleasure to welcome Marion Nessel to our microphones. She's in her office at NYU in Manhattan. Marion Nessel, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, ain't that the truth, right? Fat, salt, and sugar, it gets us all going.
It does, and they're delicious, and we all love them.
Hey, you know what I didn't say? Wait, I forgot to tell you. You wrote a book called Eat, Drink, Vote. That's why we're interviewing you. It's an illustrated guide to food politics, and it has, among other things in it, more than 50 cartoons by leading cartoonists. Sorry.
It's got 250.
Oh, my God. Oh, by 50 leading cartoonists.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, I was thinking that, because on almost every page. And but this is an illustrated guide to food politics, Eat, Drink, Vote. It is published by Rodale, and incredible stuff in it. So we all know that we're not supposed to eat a lot of fat and salt and sugar, so why the book?
Well, the book fell into my lap. I write very serious academic books about food politics, and I try to make them a little bit lighter by putting a cartoon in or two. And I love cartoons because I think that they're able to convey concepts in a really clear and funny way without hitting people over the head, which makes just what I do much easier. And in the course of trying to get permission to use a couple of cartoons in a book, in my previous book, Why Calories Count, I had a conversation with the woman who represents 50 cartoonists, and she said, let's put on a play. Let's do a book about food politics and cartoons. I thought it was a wonderful idea.
And, you know, I could, rather than thinking up my own questions, I could almost go through the table of contents for your book, Eat, Drink, Vote, and you pretty much said why an illustrated guide to food politics. It makes it more accessible. And but then the next one is food is political. In other words, why is food political?
Well, I wrote a book in 2002, now in its third edition, called Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Food is political. It's really easy to explain that. The two most important public health nutrition problems in the world today are not having enough food and having too much. Malnutrition and undernutrition and starvation and hunger on the one side, and obesity and all of its health consequences on the other. Both of those have a great deal to do with politics on the hunger side, because food is distributed unequally, and on the obesity side, because the food industry markets food so extensively. And then, in addition, food is a $1 trillion-a-year business in the United States. It's a huge, huge business, and businesses are very eager to make sure that the government never suggests eating less of their products and never does anything that makes the cost of their ingredients cost more.
Now, here in Detroit and a number of other big cities with poor populations, there are obesity, morbid obesity problems, in fact, but usually we associate poverty with starvation or hunger or threat of hunger. Why here in the United States are poor people the heaviest people?
Well, it's one of the great ironies of our food system is that poor people who often lack the means, the education, and the resources to eat healthily buy the cheapest food available. And because of federal policy, here's where we get into politics again, because of the way foods are subsidized, because of the way businesses are supported by the government, the cheapest foods are often the foods that are full of fat, sugar, and salt, and they're the ones that people love to eat in large quantities. And the more you eat and the larger the portions are, the more calories you're taking in and the more you're going to put on weight.
You think there's anything of a psychological factor, like oral gratification in lives that aren't very rewarding among the poor, that at least something that really stimulates those taste buds?
Course there is. I mean, we love to eat. It's one of life's greatest pleasures. Really, it's the one thing that you can do for yourself every day, three times a day or more, and you can give yourself pleasure by having something that you really like to eat and you love the taste and the texture and the aroma and everything else that goes with it. I mean, that's part of the reason why food is so important for people. It not only nourishes you and you need food in order to live, but it's also this enormous source of pleasure, this enormous part of culture, and the food choices that we and our friends make have a great deal to do with who we are as individuals and as groups.
Now, Tom Monahan, who is the founder of the pizza business, he said that the poor could eat very cheaply. I don't think he meant his pizzas either. He said if you just bought whole grains and fresh vegetables and some chicken parts and what have you, you could not only eat very, very cheaply, but also that you could eat in a healthful manner. I mean, he had very, very little sympathy for the poor.
Oh, I have a great deal of sympathy for the poor, so that's where we diverge, although I agree with him completely on that point. But in order to eat healthfully on very little money, and this has been shown over and over and over again by people who decide that they're going to live on food stamps for a month, even though they don't have to, they are brought up sharp very quickly about how difficult it is to eat healthfully. First of all, you have to know how to cook. You want to eat beans? Fine. You have to know how to cook them. You have to have equipment to cook them. You have to have a kitchen that functions. You have to have everything that you need in order to put a meal together. And more than anything else, you have to have the time to do it. And the education.
Sure.
But the time is the really critical problem because so many poor people are working two or three jobs in order to make ends meet. I mean, it's one of the really shocking facts about food stamps is that most of the people on food stamps are working. They have jobs. The jobs just don't pay enough.
There's a friend of ours who he and his wife have a project in an extremely poor area of Detroit in the inner city. And at some points, more than half of the people in the neighborhood do not have utilities. In other words, they can't even cook if they wanted to. And the McDonald's in that area is the highest grossing McDonald's in the state. And he and his, and this from this project, they've gone to Africa and brought back solar cookers to attempt to teach people how to cook, you know, on these little kind of contraptions that just use the sun. But it doesn't work real well in the middle of February, does it?
No, I don't think so. And you really don't want people going out and chopping wood either.
No, no, you don't. You don't need wood. You don't need wood for the solar cookers.
You don't need wood for the solar cooker. But for people who are, what are they supposed to do? Make campfires?
Yeah.
I mean, I really think that those kinds of statements come from people who don't have a clue what it's like to be poor. And to be poor in a country in the United States, to live in a neighborhood where there's no public transportation or very poor public transportation, in which there aren't utilities, in which neighborhoods are unsafe. I mean, there are a million reasons why poor people cannot get it together to try to put three meals a day on the table that they're cooking from scratch at very low cost. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that's happening in Detroit is that there are all these community gardens and gardens that are being constructed there. I think that's just a terrific trend. And the more people get into that and start growing their own food, the easier it'll be for people to start eating healthfully.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show is Marion Nessel. She's written her latest book, an illustrated guide to food politics called Eat, Drink, and Vote. Look at what the vote thing is all about in just a little while. You can go to her website, foodpolitics.com. She blogs there almost daily. There'll be a link on my website to all this, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. .com. Now, when it comes to eating good food, I saw, and you may have seen this in the papers a week or so ago, is that some of these kids, I think it was in West Virginia, said that they didn't like these healthy lunches that were being promoted by Michelle Obama. They said the food tasted like vomit. Well, I don't know. Did you happen to see that by any chance?
Yeah, I did see that.
What'd you think?
I think there's been a very concerted attack on the new school lunch rules by people who profit from the old school lunch rules. When I hear statements like that, I think, where are the adults? Where are the adults in that school? There's no reason at all why healthy food can't taste good, and everybody ought to be applauding this effort to try to make kids healthier. Every time I see one of those attacks, I think, okay, somebody here is profiting from the old system and doesn't like the new system.
You know, there was another...
That's where politics comes in,
okay.
By the way.
Yeah, all right. Well, let me say this, and then we'll get right to the vote part of your new book, Eat, Drink, and Vote. There was a show, I don't know, a year or two ago with the English cook, Jamie Oliver, who went to this mm-hmm. town in West Virginia and tried to... He had more success, but I remember he was showing kids how these chicken nuggets were made. He actually made some, and they were all going, "Oh, gross!" And then he cooked them up, and they just loved them.
There's a little disconnect there.
Yeah. So how are you going to keep them? I don't know. Down on the farm once they've had a McNugget. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, that you. I always insist that I could create vegetarian food or food with just just fishes. That would be extraordinarily healthy and extraordinarily tasty. But a lot of people, they just crave what you and I think probably isn't the best, except in little bits.
Yeah, that's true. But then you also have to take into consideration the extraordinary amount of marketing that is behind those kinds of products. The food companies who make these products make them and do focus group testing to make sure that they taste exactly the way people think they want them to taste, and then put a phenomenal amount of marketing dollars behind them to make sure that everybody thinks that that's what they're supposed to eat. And in particular, the marketing that's aimed at children is aimed at trying to convince children that they're supposed to eat foods that are made just for them. They're not supposed to eat boring old adult food that their parents are eating. They're supposed to eat kids' food, food that's made just for them. And what that does is it not only undermines any kind of parental authority around food issues, but it also makes kids think that they know more about what they're supposed to eat than their parents do. That's where the whole chicken nuggets thing comes in. So I see this as a result of marketing much more than taste. If you do taste tests, the answers come out surprising. Kids like healthy food if they know what it is, if there are people around them who think it's delicious, and in particular if they've grown it themselves and know something about where food comes from. They just love food that they make themselves.
Well, we have to, in a way, train ourselves as adults and pass that on to children. When we're training our dogs, we want to control impulse control, so they don't run across the street, what have you. You and I, when we eat a portion of something and say, "Boy, that was good. I'm going to have another identical size portion," we go, "Wait a minute. I'm not going to do it because that puts more calories, more salt, more fats into my body." So where does it start? How do we inculcate the idea that we just can't eat every single thing we want at every moment and not pay any bad consequences?
Well, it's really more complicated than that, because if you give just about anybody a large portion of food, that person will eat more calories from that large portion than from a smaller portion, and won't know it. and won't realize it. There's just tons of research now that shows this, that if you give somebody the larger the portion that you give somebody, the more they'll eat from it, even if they know they're not supposed to. And if you ask them how many calories or how much they thought they ate from it, they will underestimate the amount. So it's not just a simple matter of personal control. It's really difficult to exercise personal control over what you eat in an environment in which you're confronted with large portions of food all the time.
Well, in your book, Eat, Drink, and Vote, usually it's Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. How about Eat, Drink, Be Merry, and Vote? But that's not the name of your book. But why? Where's the vote come in? How can we as eaters or consumers, where's the voting come in here?
Well, the voting comes in because, as you said, you want to encourage people to make personal choices for the foods they eat that will be healthier. That's voting with your fork. That's what we call voting through. Every time you buy a food, every time you go to a supermarket, every time you order food at a restaurant, you're voting with your fork for what you want to eat, for the healthful qualities of what you want to eat, and for the kind of food system that you want to live in. But if we really want to change the food system so that the environment encourages people to eat more healthfully, then for that we need politics and we need to vote with our votes.
How do we do that? I mean, where are these policies up for a vote? One usually does not think of that. Maybe in the agriculture bill where
we're... Well, they're certainly up in the agriculture bill. There's no question about that. And the agriculture policy could do many things that would help people eat more healthfully. And one of them is to support the price of fruits and vegetables so that people who think that fruits and vegetables are too expensive, and they're right, would be able to afford them. And I say that they're right because Department of Commerce figures on what's happened to the relative prices of fruits and vegetables and sodas, for example, over the last 25 years, show that fruits and vegetables have increased in relative price by about 40%, and sodas have decreased in price by about 30%. So that's all federal policy that is involved in that. And if we want to change that, then we have to start getting involved in politics at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level.
Marion Nessel is my guest. She's written an illustrated guide to food politics, Eat, Drink, Vote. And the book has 250 cartoons. It's quite incredible.
In color.
In color, no less. Right. You know, I said at the beginning, you're the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. And like the Paulette Goddard for the old
the
movies?
The very one. And if you know who she is, then you're either a film buff or I know how old you are.
Maybe both.
But she was a 1940s, 1950s movie star, at one time married to Charlie Chaplin,
sure.
Or maybe not married to Charlie Chaplin, and who left a lot of money to NYU.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, and she was in some of his incredible films. In fact, I just saw this biopic called Chaplin. But on to the food, because the clock is ticking, and we want to learn more from Marion Nessel about her book, Eat, Drink, Vote. You know, a conservative listening could say, you know, Marion Nessel, just part of the nanny state, mature adults should make their own choices. And if they make bad choices, too bad. I mean, they should have to pay the consequences. Why is she and anyone else, you know, being a scold, eat your peas? You know, we all heard that when we were kids. Why? I guess is the question.
Well, I already talked about the business with large portions. And we don't make food choices in a vacuum. We make food choices in a food environment that is set up to sell us more food, not less. The way I like to put it is if you want to do something about obesity, you need to eat less, eat better, and move more. Eating less is really, really bad for business. Really bad. And businesses don't like it. They have to sell food in order to survive. And not only do they have to make a profit, but they have to grow their profits every 90 days or Wall Street gets very, very cross with them. So if you want to create a healthier food environment, there's some things that nanny states do that make things better for everyone, particularly because we pick up the healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that obesity is not a cosmetic problem. That's not really what the problem is. The problem is that it's a risk factor for diabetes and heart disease and other kinds of conditions that are very, very expensive and horrible for people and horrible to treat and cost society a great deal of money, not only in healthcare costs, but also in lost productivity. And taxpayers pick up that bill. If we had a better healthcare system, taxpayers would still be picking it up, but it might not be so bad. So I think it's unreasonable to think that people make food choices completely independently and that they suffer the consequences of those choices independently. They don't. Someone who is ill is not only personally in trouble, but also has an enormous effect on their families, their friends, their healthcare system, and everything else.
Well,
we live in a very interconnected society.
In Eat, Drink, Vote, you talk about taxing junk food and sodas. That was tried by the soon-to-be ex-mayor Bloomberg, and it didn't go anywhere. And one of the arguments against that was you're going to be taxing the poor. In other words, Mary Nessel, you're a professor at NYU, and if you decide you want to have a Coca-Cola, which you, I suspect, probably don't, I don't, and it's all of a sudden, I have no idea, instead of a dollar and a quarter, suddenly they were $1.75, I don't think that would hurt either of us at all. But a poor person who consumes, pretty much even addicted to the caffeine and the sugar, that begins to hit them. So the idea that, and this is what I was getting at, and this is like the libertarian argument, this is nanny state trying to control people's consumption that just winds up hurting them and actually hurting their pocketbook as well.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem, part of it is, I would be much more sympathetic to that argument if soda companies didn't put so much effort into marketing to poor people, specifically marketing to poor people, with specific efforts to market in poor communities, with specific efforts to market to African Americans and Hispanic Americans, with enormous efforts to market in poor inner city areas where people don't have choices. And so this is being done deliberately, and it's very difficult to know how to deal with that without changing our social structure in a way that we somehow get more money to people who need it. But in the meantime, here are companies who are profiting from the ill health of people who don't have any money, and that seems unfair to me.
Well, I started off the conversation that we're having with saying that the foods that really attract us are laden with fat, salt, and sugar. And I said, I think almost everyone knows that in excess, those aren't good. Almost every American wants to lose weight, and yet there seems to be no change. What are the obstacles? I mean, you mentioned one, marketing, the whole culture, big portions. Can we control that in restaurants? People love, I love to go there. They've got so much food, I can take it home.
Portions weren't always this big. This is a relatively recent phenomenon that occurred exactly in parallel with rising rates of obesity. I think large portions are a sufficient explanation for rising rates of obesity. Larger portions have more calories. If I had one concept I could communicate to everybody, it would be that one, because it's not intuitively obvious, and research shows that it's not intuitively obvious. This is something that we changed. We can change it back. Not easily, but we can. I mean, there are ways in which we could encourage restaurants to serve smaller portions. People who wanted more could always have more. I mean, in a sense, that's what Bloomberg's 16-ounce soda cap was trying to do. He was trying to say that the default soda would be 16 ounces, which is two standard servings. It's not even one, it's two standard servings. And that if people wanted more, they could order more. But we know from human psychology that people won't. Most people won't. 16 ounces is plenty of soda for most people. But if more is there, they will eat more because we're human and that's what we do.
Yeah. Coca-Cola's used to be, 8 ounces in that
yeah,
bottle.
Something like that. Yeah. 7.5, 6 yeah. and a half. Right, a long time ago, and they discovered that larger portions sold really well. People love bargains, and it costs them, because of the way the pricing structure works, it costs them so little to make a bigger one that even if they charge what seems like a bargain amount over and above what a smaller one would cost, they still make a great deal of money.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. Incredible book, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. It's 250 cartoons. My favorite is a doctor talking to a guy saying, I'm taking you off wine, women, and song, and putting you on whole grains. My guest has been Marion Nessel. The book is available from Rodale, and her website is foodpolitics.com. All of this, links and what have you, will be on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Thanks for being on the broadcast.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
This next song goes out to someone real special. Web developers. You've developed a World Wide Web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code, and that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
Business owners and professionals face special challenges in divorce court. In addition to everything else going on, they have to contend with allegations that they are earning more than they are, coupled with claims on their business or practices themselves.
Attorney, CPA, Joe Cordell.
An effective defense often hinges on subtle and sophisticated strategies, on things such as business valuations, income allocations, and tax income projections. Clients with assets depend on their divorce lawyer's skills in these matters, and that's why it's so important to hire someone that has those skills.
The domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell is the partner men can count on, particularly in the face of complex litigation. Cordell & Cordell, offering sophisticated solutions for men in divorce. 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor. 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Syria is certainly the crisis of this era. And I don't mean the eras I have shortened so much, but maybe you could even say the crisis of the last few weeks. They seem to come fast and furious. And this is one unusual in the fact that it involves war, and the American people are against it, not just the same noisy crew of which I am a part usually, or I would say almost always, but rather the American people almost as one voice saying no. But there's so many aspects of this. I mean, who actually did the chemical warfare? Who are the rebels? Why is the one force linked with the other? What's going on here? Why is the president of Russia, Putin, taking out, or not taking out, but being offered an op-ed piece in the New York Times? Well, when these questions go through my mind and I don't have really sharp answers for them, I go to Stephen Zunis. He's been on this show any number of times. He's a professor of politics and chair of the Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, and we're reaching him in his office today in San Francisco. Stephen Zunis, as usual, welcome back to the broadcast.
Good to be on again.
Yeah, well, it is unusual that so many of the Americans right out of the chute are against the war. This is kind of unusual, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, you have the usual left liberal crowd who has historically been skeptical of U.S. military intervention. But you also have a more, you know, libertarian-oriented conservatives who believe that U.S. Military involvement should only take place if there are very clear national security interests at stake. You also, of course, have the Republicans who will oppose anything that Obama's for. But by and large, I think what we're seeing is a reaction to the lies that were told to us about Iraq, The effect of the Afghanistan intervention went well beyond simply going after Al-Qaeda cells, but you know, ended up getting us involved in tribal war in Central Asia. And both the financial and human and other costs of war, Americans are war weary, and given the enormous complexity of the Syrian conflict, this reluctance is genuine and very wide and very deep. Polls show at least 2-1 margin opposing it. It's very unlikely that the president will get authorization in the House of Representatives, and this may in fact be a historic moment, the first time to my knowledge that an American president has wanted to go to war, and the people have succeeded in preventing it.
You may have seen the New York Times poll. It said the largest group opposing the bombing of Syria, essentially war, an act of war, were Republicans. Second were independents. And the people that were given President Obama the largest support, around 50%, were the Democrats. This sort of stands everything on its head.
Yes, I have one congresswoman I know referred to it as an aviary conundrum, where hawks have become doves and doves have become hawks.
I like that.
But the... And certainly I can really appreciate the humanitarian appeal. I am convinced that the Syrian government was behind the chemical weapons attack, and it was indeed absolutely horrendous. I do believe there is a qualitative difference regarding the use of chemical weapons as opposed to other kinds of ordnance. Even if we were to assume that the basis of this proposed intervention is that of liberal internationalism, as opposed to imperialism or more crass parochial interests, there are still serious questions about the efficacy of war. Would this material damage that we could do to the Syrian regime's military assets, so that be more than made up by the increased political support he would likely get? I mean, people tend to rally around the flag when their country is bombed. Assad, despite everything, still has a supportive, substantial minority of Syrians. Any hope of getting defense within the Ba'ath party elite. And it's important to remember that Syria is not just one-man rule. It's more of an oligarchy. The chances of getting divisions within the ranks of the ruling elite would lessen, of course, as people tend to close ranks again if they're under foreign attack. And indeed, historically, we found that when there has been military intervention in civil wars, it's tended to, even if it's done in the name of stopping oppression, it's tended to make things worse instead of better. What happens is that the regime tends to figure, we have nothing to lose now. The gloves are really off this time. And the opposition says, hey, we don't need to negotiate or compromise. We can just fight even harder. And, again, statistically, the death toll goes up. The length of the war extends. I mean, even when we think about so-called successful interventions like Serbia, which also had support of more Democrats than Republicans, yes, the Serbian regime is doing terrible things in Kosovo. The counterinsurgency campaign against the Kosovo Liberation Army included, some serious human rights abuses. But the wholesale ethnic cleansing and the big massacres took place only after NATO bombing began. A lot of people forget that. We still hear, NATO intervened in response to ethnic cleansing. No, the ethnic cleansing was in response to the NATO bombing. And so I think a lot of the liberals, a lot of respect the liberals' humanitarian impulse. And indeed, if I thought that U.S. intervention would end up saving lives and being an effective deterrent against further use of chemical weapons, would help bring down Assad and replace it by a stable democratic government, I might support it myself, despite the fact that it's illegal. Everything I look at it, I mean, every scenario, I would say there's at least an 80% chance that it would do more harm than good.
My guest is Stephen Zunis. He's professor of politics and chair of the Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. We're talking about the situation in Syria. You can go to his website, stephenzunis.org. That's Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, last name Zunis, Z-U-N-E-S.org. Also, there'll be links on my website, Peter Werby. com. I wonder, I pose this to an aspiring Republican politician who had sent me an email about opposing the bombing of Syria, and I wrote her back and said, gee, I wonder if it was President Romney who had been calling for a retaliatory or a punishing strike. Would she and the other Republicans be opposed to it? I tend to think not. What do you think?
Yeah, I think a lot of Republican opposition is partisan, is opportunistic, and I think at least to some degree the Democratic support has to do with wanting to support a Democratic president. Again, people tend to trust Obama's motivations, I think, more than they would Bush and the gang, that he does not have this conservative vision of empire and dominance, that that his motivation is out of sincere, if in my view, very misguided, myopic liberal internationalism. I think in issues of war and peace, it's important to transcend partisanship, as there have been many on both sides. Despite heavy arm twisting by House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi, you're getting a lot of people balking, particularly in the Progressive Caucus, because they're really hearing from the constituents loud and clear. I mean, by huge margins, people are calling in saying no, don't do it. And, of course, on the Republican side, you have people like John McCain, who's never seen a war he didn't like, not to mention, of course, Eric Cantor and John Boehner on the House side. The Republican leadership there are really pushing for war as well. I think there. In other words, I think there's some good arguments and bad arguments on both sides. I come down to the opposing going to war pretty strongly, in fact. But whatever one's opinion, I really hope people do it based more on their best thinking, not on the party of the president who's opposing it.
I want to get back to that in a minute, but I wanted to clear up something you mentioned, Stephen Tunis, with great assuredness. It sounded that it was, in fact, the Assad regime who had used the chemical weapons. There is a lot floating around on the liberal left and the left itself that the intelligence is bad, that it could very well have been the rebels, or that at worst it could have been a low-level unit that used these chemical weapons, and the higher-ups in the Syrian army and certainly in the Assad regime were horrified, because it seems crazy that they would have used them and used them on who they did, and particularly when there were UN inspectors just about to arrive. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was initially skeptical myself, actually, for the other reasons that you mentioned, including the fact that President Obama was pretty clear that this could provoke military intervention. I've seen no serious reports indicating that the rebels were able to procure chemical weapons. Yes, there have been some defections and bases overrun, but the Assad regime, for obvious reasons, have been keeping their chemical stockpile in pretty secure areas. Also, the fact is that this area where the chemical weapons attack occurred is an area just east of the capital, which has been in rebel hands for more than a year. It's from there they have launched a mortar attack into Damascus, including one that hit the main university there, killing a number of students. It's where an apparent assassination attempt of Assad was launched several weeks ago. And also, it controls a major highway. In fact, I've been on that road. I've been through that area. That has been making it difficult for the Syrians to send reinforcements to join the fighting elsewhere in the country, where they've actually been making some gains in recent months. And they've been very frustrated at their inability to clear that area. So, yeah, I think one could see a strategic rationale despite everything. But also, the fact is that the Assad regime, I would not overestimate their intelligence strategically. I mean, they could have stopped this rebellion in the very beginning when it was nonviolent if they had given in to some initially very modest and reasonable demands. Remember, there were, after the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, you had uprisings in a half dozen different Arab countries, and places like Oman and Jordan and Morocco used only moderate repression combined with some reforms, which were able to nip these protests in the bud. They could have done that in Syria quite easily, but instead they ended up massacring people. And people outraged at the massacres came out in the streets in larger numbers and massacred them, And that got even more people out in the streets, et cetera. And then eventually, out of desperation, I think this is a very bad move strategically, they end up taking up arms, which, of course, then gave the regime excuse for even further repression, and the death toll started going up tenfold. So, you know, I am, in other words, what I'm saying is that I wouldn't, the Syrian regime has made a whole series of strategic and tactical mistakes from the beginning. So I wouldn't put it past them to do something like this, which, in addition to the obvious legal and moral ramifications, is indeed pretty counterproductive.
You recently wrote the piece, The U.S. and Chemical Weapons, No Leg to Stand On. I wonder if you could just go through that a little. I think all of us are, at least hopefully, aware that they were poison gas was used in World War I. It horrified the world. There was a 1925 treaty that forbid it. But I think one of the most admired Western statesmen historically has been Winston Churchill. But I wonder if you could kind of talk about that a little and how and when poison gases have been used since World War I.
Well, the first use of chemical weapons was by the British with a strong support of Churchill, who, not yet prime minister, but had a major position in government. And he said, saw nothing wrong with using gas against these backward tribes, as he called them, when the British were reconquering Iraq following the Ottoman rule. The Egyptians used chemical weapons in Yemen when they intervened in that civil war in the mid-1960s. The U.S.-backed Egyptian military junta still has chemical weapons, so we have not been pressing them to disarm them. The biggest use of chemical weapons, there's some other cases, the Italian fascists in Ethiopia, for example, but the biggest use, of course, was Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war. And the Reagan administration had no objections to that. In fact, CIA documents have been released just recently, which is confirmed what I and other people have been writing about for some years. And that is that there are officials from U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency on the ground in Baghdad using U.S. satellite data to inform the Iraqi armed forces where there are concentrations of Iranian troops, in the full knowledge that the Iraqis were going to be targeting them using chemical weapons. Indeed, many of the key components of the chemical weapons were of U.S. manufacture, sent ostensibly as part of pesticides, fertilizer, and the like. And congressional hearings in the 90s showed that the U.S. officials were aware that that the Iraqis were using that material to build chemical bombs, but the aid kept on flowing. Congress in the late 1980s had the Iraq Genocide Prevention Act saying, look, they're using chemical weapons not just Iranian troops, but against Kurdish civilians, but we need to put on sanctions, and the senior Bush administration blocked it. In fact, when the Iraqis used chemical weapons against the Kurdish town of Halabja after it had been overrun by pro-Iranian Kurdish militia, the U.S. covered up for the massacre, even trying to blame it on the Iranians, who were the preferred enemy. And then the great irony is that 15 years later, President Bush uses the fact that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein gassed his own people as an excuse for invading the country, even though it was 10 years after they had fully eliminated their chemical weapons arsenal. And indeed, the fact that not just Bush administration officials like Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld lied about WMDs, but the fact that you have senators like John Kerry and Joe Biden, who are now Secretary of State and Vice President, insisting that Iraq had chemical weapons that most of us who actually studied realized we'd gotten rid of years ago, with Kerry even saying they have more chemical weapons than they did before the Gulf War and they can reach the United States. I mean, just ridiculous stuff. All of us who seriously studied this stuff knew were lies. Now he's trying to be the administration's big point man of convincing them that the Syrian regime used chemical weapons. Even Nancy Pelosi, he's been doing a lot of arm twisting in the House to get Democrats to support it. She's saying that the Syrian regime's use of chemical weapons is undeniable. Well, in November of 2002, on Meet the Press, she said there was no question that Iraq still had chemical weapons. So, again, even though I think they're right this time in terms of Syria, of course people are going to be skeptical.
Well,
after being lied to by the same politicians, that are trying to push for war over another chemical weapons issue. No wonder that nearly a quarter of the American public, and probably even a bigger majority outside the United States, simply don't believe them.
Well, it would be, one would think, that it would be a pretty awful country that would possess chemical weapons. Is there any particular country other than Syria that has them? This is a very leading question, if you're listening. The United States, right?
We are in the process of disarming. In addition to the 1925 Geneva Protocol, which banned the use of chemical weapons, there's an international treaty in 1993 that called for their total elimination. And all but eight countries are parties to that treaty. The United States pledged to get rid of its arsenal. We are several years behind. We missed the deadline, in fact. But we've gotten rid of about 80% of it. I think it has more to do with the fact that we had by far the world's largest chemical weapons arsenal, and they're just the sort of more technical, logistical things. And I think perhaps we could have put a little more money and effort into keeping up to the deadline, but we're on our way out to eliminating them. But I think the bigger issue, the bigger question, is that we have long demanded, and we are now demanding with the threat of war, that Syria eliminate its chemical weapons. But the reason they have chemical weapons was in response to Israel and Egypt having chemical weapons, in the case of Israel, biological and nuclear weapons as well. Israel started developing its weapons of mass destruction before Syria did. And Syria has called for a weapons of mass destruction free zone for the entire Middle East. And indeed, the UN Security Council Resolution 687, which eliminated Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, that said quite explicitly that Iraqi disarmament was the first step towards region-wide disarmament of WMDs. But the U.S. has failed to follow up on that. And so Syria, when they were a non-permanent member of the U.N. Security Council in December 2003, put forward a draft resolution for making a WMD-free zone for the Middle East. It was tabled because of a threatened United States veto. And the unilateral sanctions U.S. put on Syria that same year, in part because of their chemical weapons, demanded that Syria unilaterally give up their weapons while increasing military aid and cooperation with the militaries of Israel and Egypt. So, this is a double standard, this idea that, hey, if you're an ally of the United States, we'll let you get away with having these weapons, but if you have those things or are alleged to have those things in the case of Iraq, we will go to war against you. And that just isn't going to work. And, of course, we had in the case of Iraq, when they were an ally, we were defending them, and then when they weren't, we were invading them. But arms control is going to work. It needs to be universal in principle. We can't just have this kind of WMD apartheid where the United States gets to unilaterally decide who gets to have these horrific weapons and who doesn't.
Well, this is a tough question. We should tell people that we're recording this on Thursday, September 12th, because who knows what's going to happen between now and when this is aired on Sunday. But it appears that everything is on hold, that on Tuesday night, President Obama was expected to announce why force was necessary to punish Syria. Now he's called for some diplomatic solutions to examine the Putin and Syrian proposal that their chemical weapons be placed under the control of the United Nations. And this is going back and forth. Can Syria be trusted? Will they actually be able to find all of them? All of that. Where do you, knowing that we have another 3-4 days before this airs, what do you feel comfortable about saying about the possible outcomes?
Well, this probably isn't going to be resolved for weeks, but this is quite logistically possible. For one thing, as I mentioned, as part of this 1993 treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons, there are many thousands of technical experts who, for the past 20 years, have been going into countries, securing their chemical arsenals, and disarming them, or removing them, or until they disarmed elsewhere. So on the technical and logistical side, it can very easily be done. Now, it's never been done in a country in the middle of war, but presumably the Syrians have their stockpiles in very secure areas. In terms of keeping track of it all, Syria's chemical weapons arsenal has been of concern long before the the apparent use of them back on August 21st, in fact, well beyond the start of the Civil War. We have satellites, with cameras and incredible resolutions. I mean, can literally read the license plate on the back of a car. So, U.S. intelligence services and others have a pretty good idea of what the Syrian regime has and where. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's, the technical problems are at all insurmountable. And I think this has actually I'm not a big fan of Vladimir Putin, put it mildly, but I think in this particular case, he has helped create kind of a win-win situation that I think has a much greater chance of getting rid of their chemical weapons and bombing everyone.
Well, we have about a minute left, and this is a pretty involved question. That is the impact of all of this on President Obama. The Republicans see blood in the water, and they're already saying that he's humiliated the country, he's shown himself as incompetent. How badly do you think this is going to hurt, President Obama, but people are also saying that this hurts our country as well, the fact that he's so indecisive, as they characterize it.
It would hurt our country a lot more if we violated the United Nations Charter and basic principles of international law by unilaterally attacking Syria. This idea that we can enforce a violation of international law by violating international law itself ourselves would not go over well in the world. Our credibility would be far more hurt, I believe, going unilaterally when the vast majority of the world, from the Arab League to the Secretary General to Pope Francis and just about everybody else, is saying don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama acted unilaterally and bombed without going to Congress, he'd be in direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. I disagree with his push to go to war in the first place, the fact that he did go to Congress and the fact that he is consulting with other nations, I think he should be given credit for. And I think, indeed, if by doing these two things prevents an illegal, unnecessary war from taking place, I think history will be far more kind to him than his critics are currently.
Well, I want to thank you so much, as usual, for being on the broadcast. I said at the beginning, when I have questions about particularly the Middle East, I want to go to Stephen Zunis. So we've done this for the last 25 minutes. But there's a lot more that Professor Zunis has to say. You can go to his website, StephenZunis.org. That's STEPHEN, and his last name, ZUNES.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Many of Stephen's articles and his analyses are there. And you'll do much better taking the time to read those than watching the nightly news, believe me. As usual, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIN. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Seth Green and Giovanni Ribisi starring Dads, premiering tomorrow at 8 o'clock on Fox 2 Detroit. To celebrate, you could win a $250 gift card. Tune in tomorrow from 3 to 8 p.m. to win, or log on WRIF.com.
Getting you back to the rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bigger. Badder. Wolf-hackier.
Wait, that's not a word.
WRIF Sin City Takeover 2013. Listen for your chance to join the Riff Wolfpack in Vegas. Or get more details at WRIF.com.
shine on me with more than I ever thought I had. Make me see the release in the words that I share.